news jobs. They're old, grumpy, and are pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode number 90, the first one of 2018. Happy New Year, Mark.
Yes, happy to New Year to you as well. And what I say, you've seen the New Year in not the best way, have you? You've been a bit ill. Oh. Or have you been milking it?
I haven't been milking it, if only. there's nothing good to come out of Australia. That's all we need to say.
Australia. Oh, I don't know, Crocodile Dundee, Neighbours.
Natalie Imbruglia.
That's about it. Oh yeah, you just hit the nail on the head. I know they said Mark Hunt then, but he's a Kiwi, he's New Zealand.
Ah, is he? Yeah, well, I've had the Aussie flu and I don't seem alone looking at Facebook. Well, put it this way, I was so ill that I didn't look at Facebook, I couldn't look at my phone, I couldn't even watch Netflix, like lay in bed in the fetal position, feeling sorry for myself. I was that ill that I don't know, I was reassessing my life choices, put it that way. It was not good for more than the usual 5 minutes when you get ill.
It wasn't just an old man hangover then?
No, I thought it was at first, and then the symptoms, like it's like a heavy migraine. Like, I don't get migraines, so you know, I get a headache when I've got a hangover, and if I'm really dehydrated, sometimes when you're setting up fishing, you know, and you're rushing down there, and then you're doing stuff all day, I sometimes get like a stress headache, like towards the end of me setting up, and you know, quite often on that first night's fishing, I have to take a few tablets and literally just get in bed. I think some of it is when you're setting up into the dark as well, you've got your head torch on, so you're wearing your head torch for quite a few hours setting up. Do you ever get like a dull headache from wearing a head torch? I think it's just like a pressure thing. I get it with tight hats sometimes, you know, like your winter hats. I get a headache with a tight hat.
I never really have, to be honest. You know, and I've done a lot of setting up under the head torch in the past, and probably the future as well. That's just the hours I get to fish. But
yeah, I do. I don't know. I wouldn't say I've always had it, but definitely in the last 15 years, if I wear a, you know, if it's winter and I'm setting up and I've got like a hat, and not even a hat that I would say is too tight, but just that constant pressure around my sort of forehead and head.
Do you not think to slacken it off a touch?
Well, I can only wear certain hats. Like, I've got a collection, obviously, probably the same as you. I've got millions of them, fishing hats from over the years, and they're usually one size, aren't they? And just if they're slightly on the snugger side, then they give me headaches after an hour or two. But yeah, I get the same wearing a head torch. It's that type of migraine, this Aussie flu starts, but really sensitive to light. I've been in a darkened room. If you haven't had it for more than 7 days, then you probably haven't had Aussie flu, because that seems to be everyone I've spoke to, and it seems to be a lot of people, they're saying it's 10 days to 14 days. I spent a full 7 days in bed without getting out. Headache, sick feeling, everything, any smell of food or anything made me want to be sick. On the bright side, I lost a stone in weight in just over 7 days.
I'm not sure it's the best or safest way of doing it, and it was probably a lot of it was fluid rather than, you know, proper weight shedding, a bit of fat, but still, yeah, well done.
Yeah, it was really hard to even keep water down, because everything made you want to be sick, the smell of everything. You know, all you had to sick up was the water, so the doctor recommended like just take a sip like every few minutes, just so it goes into your body rather than you know, it is an amount of liquid that you can be sick, that you can sick up again. But yeah, it was migraines, sickness, fever, like just hot and cold constant. I had a fever, a temperature of 39 for 5 days. Which, after googling it, is, I didn't realise that a fever is actually your body's way of getting rid of the virus. Your body deliberately raises its temperature to try and kill off the virus, started to make you an inhospitable host, which I didn't know. So,
The body is a very, very complex and wonderful thing.
Yeah, clever.
I mean, going off topic there, I was listening to another one of Joe Rogan's podcasts with that Rhonda Patrick this morning, and wow, fascinating stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway. Did we talk about Worth a Look the other day? Something I said, remind me, we'll do that as a Worth a Look.
The only Worth a Look I can think of is one you put me on to, the True Geordie podcast. I'm quite liking that one.
Worth a Look.
Yeah, you listened to a few of them.
Yeah, I have. You know, the, what's that, World's Strongest Man, Eddie Hall.
Yeah.
You know, he was on, that was a good interview.
Is it all sports related, would you say? I mean, obviously the one I put you on to was a poker player going out with a girl that's got multiple personality disorder, but which has nothing to do with sports really, but...
No, it's not all. He's had... who was that fellow who was in The Inbetweeners? Who's done everything? You know, the actor who played him, he's been on, and he had one of the Game of Thrones actors on. I've listened to a few. Then he has had some sports people on. He's had Alan Shearer. He's done one with Robbie Williams, which...
Really?
I wouldn't exactly say that's my taste of music by a long shot, but it was a very interesting podcast. I will give him that.
I wouldn't mind watching that one. Yeah,
Robbie Williams, he does a lot of...
He doesn't have much to do in music these days, but he's got a pretty interesting story, hasn't he? So, yeah, so there is a Worth a Look. Definitely. What's it called? True Geordie Podcast.
Yeah, the True Geordie Podcast is on iTunes and all the usual platforms, and it's got quite a popular YouTube channel as well.
Yeah. Yeah, they seem to be... yeah, they seem to be quite good. Got a nice delivery. I've only watched the ones with the guy that I know, Charlie Carroll, who's... Yeah, he's a poker player. He turned £15 into how many million? I forget how many million now.
Yeah, I think on the podcast he said 5.7.
Yeah, and I think he's won quite a few more since.
In counting.
Yeah, and he's very, I don't know what you would describe him as. He's quite into his psychedelic drugs. He believes it's a crime against humanity that they're illegal in a lot of countries. And he's got a girlfriend who's a cam girl model who's got multiple personality disorders. She's got 7 different personalities at completely different personas, characters, which I actually watched a film about somebody with DID, I think they call it now. Yeah, I actually watched a film recently, quite a newish film that came on Netflix. Very interesting. Open your mind to other stuff that's going on there. Sounds like a lot of extra stress in your life, though, to be totally truthful. But shout out to Charlie Carroll, who definitely won't be listening to a fishing podcast. But
I'm sure the True Geordie won't be anyway, but shout out to him as well.
Yeah, I'm going to listen to some other ones. I know there's a couple of people there you said that I won't mind.
I think he's up to, besides his, he's just like live commentaries on football. His mates having a beer, watching Newcastle matches, and he did the McGregor fight as well with Mayweather, and quite a few things. So,
clunk. Is that your big toe just booting the microphone?
No, I'm back on my old desk, and it's got like a tray underneath, which in olden days a keyboard would have come out on. And I've just uncrossed my legs and booted it one. So I'll try and keep still. I'm also back on my creaky chair, so I'm sat as still as I can.
Yeah, my mic's going through a new old compressor. It's a compressor I've had for about 10 years, but I've never wired it up with this current setup. But I have now, so it should be nice and boomingly nice. Got the dog sat on my knees, just fired, which wasn't very pleasant. Certain dog foods affected more than others. Obviously, the really expensive stuff, he never farts. But yeah, certain other reports. One the other day, we'd run out of dog food, so we just got some from the shop at the end of the road, just a local sort of convenience shop, and it was about the best one that they did, Baker's or something. Anyways, they were like orange nuggets, and they look like about the size, the big size halibut pellets. To be honest, they look really good for bait. They were quite a spongy. They were not rock hard like a pellet, that you could squeeze them a bit, but they were, they'd stay on a hook, I think, or on a hair rig. I looked at them and thought they'd be really good for bait, but they're like an orangey brown colour, and his shit comes out identical. You could literally chop these up in sausages and put them back in his bowl. It looks identical. What goes in, what goes out, that can't be very good, can it, if it just looks identical, orange colour. And then we went back to his normal food. Yesterday was the first day he had it. And then we took him for a walk this morning in the hailstone, which he didn't like. And he did this turd. And, like, the first 15% of this turd was this orange stuff. And then the rest of the sausage was, like, a different colour. So you can literally see how much was left inside him of, like, the orange food. And then it was quite funny to look at. I was like, can definitely see.
Yeah, you've not posted any pictures.
No, I don't post pictures of the dog's turd. It's funny, his little routines. If you take him for a long enough walk, and you've got to take him for long enough, but he does one massive turd. Ben, mine's a Jack Russell and he's tiny. He does one massive one and then stops, and then we'll walk for another 10-15 minutes, and then he'll do like a really small one. And this is every single time you take him out. Like, it is one big one and one small one. And if you go home before the small one, you'll need to go back out again. So I don't know if he saves it or what he's doing, but it's just quite curious. He's extremely, extremely regular on his routine. But yeah.
Yeah. I think we've all got routines. Routines are good for people. I know I've got a routine, and whenever, colours of poos, I always know when I've been eating too many flapjacks because they come out speckled.
I like a flapjack as well, but it always feels like starch.
I've got three today. I love them.
Yeah, they can't be good for
three in Holland and Barrett's.
No way. Holland and Barrett's, isn't that for healthy food? Flapjack's got to be one of the least healthy things you can eat, surely. It's just stodgy.
If you're in Holland and Barrett's, they must be healthy. that's my logic, anyway. I just popped in some probiotic tablets, which they were on offer 2-for-1, so I was quite happy about that. So I thought I'd treat myself to some flapjacks with the money I'd saved.
excuse me, just the remnants of Australia. What do probiotics do? Have you noticed like a positive benefit? Is it all that healthy bacteria in your gut? Is it all that sort of stuff?
It is, yeah. It just levels out your gut biome. And I mean, have you been on antibiotics?
I have, yeah, towards the end.
Yeah. Well, I'd complete the course, let it do its job, but I'd 100% go on probiotics when you finish them, because what antibiotics do, not only do they wipe out the nasties, your Aussie flu, they'll wipe out all the good bacteria in your gut, which your own immune system depends quite a lot on. So just one of these probiotics a day, there's something like 3 billion good bacteria or what have you. I just take one a day with my evening meal, along with the other bits and bobs. And, touch wood and drop my phone. I've not that often I get ill.
Yeah, well,
So I have,
I don't know. If I start taking them and get a cold, then obviously they're rubbish. Yeah.
Then I think it's down to some other factors. But yeah, I remember when I first started them, I didn't poo for about 3 days, and then the cable of all cables came forth.
I didn't poo for 2 weeks, but that's because I wasn't eating. But yeah,
you didn't have anything going through.
No, nothing. Yeah, I think in 7 days I had half a bowl of soup. Just not even hungry. Not even like I wanted to eat. It was just no. Oh, it was horrible. I wouldn't wish it on. Maybe a couple of people, but not most people. But anyway, that's kind of a kibosh to fishing. I was looking to get out fishing. There was a week of quite nice weather mildish weather while I was laid up, and which combined with the season tickets starting on Clearwater, there was about 7 fish out the first weekend. I think there seemed to be quite a few. And then the weather's just gone pretty grim up north since then. I noticed there's a bit of wind and rain about at the minute. Friend of the show and my partner in the Northern Angling Show, Spenny, he's on Orchid, which seems to be doing a few fish. Leon Michaels, Carpcast fan, who came on one of the Church Lake trips, he's had a couple. He got there yesterday evening, I think, or the day before. Spenny's had a 34.5 fish known as Delilah out of the Alamo. Nice. And it seems to me that some lakes seem to have fished consistently since Christmas. Have you noticed that? It seems to be the same places doing fish.
Yeah, each year in Orchid has just got an unrivaled reputation for winter catches, and this year's proving no different. I know my syndicate Monk's Pit has got quite a good winter form, and it is, I don't say it's been fishing well by a long chalk, but it is doing, you know, the odd fish. It's not shut up at any time. It's, you know, mostly to zigs, I believe, but
I saw a poke. Dog sitting on my knee and he keeps moving around. Apologies if he keeps bashing the mic. But I saw Crowy make a post on Twitter. I'll try and find it actually. It was last week, and the post was along the lines of, I'll find his exact wording, but it was along the lines of, his general gist was, there's so many people carp fishing these days, you know, and the real keenies that are fishing right through the winter, that catch reports are just flying in, and it's like the fish don't shut up shop anymore. I'll try and find like how he worded it, because that was a bit long-winded for 180 characters, wasn't it?
Thinking about that, a lot more people are carp fishing, which, you know, percentages, a lot more people are going to be keep going straight through the winter. But also another change is the nature of a lot of these day ticket venues that are doing the fish. You know, a lot of it is geared in favour of the angler and not the fish. Like, if we'd have carried on through on, I don't know, Elstow 1, you know, a good stock of fish, and it was very, very hard.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, a lot of it, there's, you know, don't want to sound like I'm talking down or demeaning anything, but it's not as hard as it used to be.
So what?
That's unfair.
There's more fish in lakes. I hadn't really thought of that. Crowy's put, I love the carp industry, but I wish there was still a close season, because it never seems to slow anymore. Even winter is manic with folk going fishing 24/7. Now, most lakes are quiet. Like, this, it's still not busy anywhere, but I'm guessing your likes, your places that are known for a bit of winter form, maybe Christchurch, maybe Orchid. I think Farlow's has been throwing fish up. You know, those sort of places. Yeah. I'm guessing that the prime swims on those lakes are busy, probably most weeks. But I know, like, Clearwater, that first weekend it opened, I think it was a dozen on, and there's only been one or two a night since then, I think. I don't know, really, but it does seem to be the same lakes, you know, the sort of known winter lakes. But.
Yeah, it is another factor, the equipment, the waterproofs, and, you know, the bivvies we've got nowadays. It makes winter fishing in even the worst conditions, like it is out today at the minute, a lot more bearable, a lot more enjoyable.
Yeah,
you haven't got a bed chair sticking out the end of your brolly with a bin bag over it to keep your feet dry. Not that you'd know if they got wet, because they were freezing anyway.
Yeah, I remember fishing Christmas Day one year as a keen kid. Went out for the afternoon, and that exact scenario, it was wet and windy and muddy, and it was the old Lafuma type bed chairs, whatever they were, the Argos ones, and bin bag over the end of it, on a 50 inch new brolly, and yeah, it was unpleasant. Then it collapsed in the mud, and I went home. once you lay in the mud and everything's wet and damp, that's the end of it. But yeah, there's, I'm just looking on Carp Feed.
It's on the net in association with carpfeed.com. So it's definitely true.
The picture of a lady, Kelly Crush is her name. First session on a new syndicate water, produced a fish that hasn't been caught for 3 years. It's 38/12, and it's now known as Kelly's fish. It looks like it's in Kent, the venue. But obviously a big result for her. But not been out for 3 years. It's a funny time of year for fish to be caught like that. Normally when you get the fish that haven't been out for quite a while, it normally comes in like the autumn, when, you know, the fish have really dropped the guard or whatever. But also had three other fish off the same spot. I've noticed another chap had 240s in 20 minutes, went up on January
another one on his next trip. Yeah, it's not just, you know, a couple of 40s within 20 minutes. It's a New Forest water park, wasn't it? That was a phenomenal catch any time of year. Never mind January.
Yeah.
You know,
two-day sessions a day apart, which produced 3 40s and a flurry of 30s. The Wiltshire Angler bagged 2 40s in just 20 minutes in the New Forest Park before returning the next day to catch a 43-pounder and 5 30s. That's pretty incredible.
How would that do to buy my lottery ticket?
Yeah, well, if you can catch some sort of fish in winter, why would anybody stop fishing? That's another one. Yeah. I saw that big common from the Cardiff Wharf. That's a place I'd like to fish, you know. The Wharf, is it?
Yeah.
It comes up in the news fairly regular now, that place. It looks interesting. You've obviously seen all these sort of urban shots of the Wharf, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's fairly iconic, isn't it?
Yeah, I have seen the shots, and, you know, it's each to their own, but I can't think of anywhere worse to fish, to be honest.
No?
You know, I like to get as far away from civilization as possible. My fishing is my sanctuary. You know, I don't want to see another human being, not be fishing in this shadow of everybody. But I say each to their own. It does some good fish, and I'm sure the lads down there love it.
Yeah, there's been a few articles on Carp Feed about the Wharf all winter. There was one December the 12th. It says the Wharf's on fire. This one was on January the 11th. It's a big Welsh Commons. Another picture of a guy with a fully scaled at night. Same chap. Damien Jones. The Wharf. I don't know if there's a particular reason. I know there's quite a lot of our listeners do fish there. A couple of Nash guys are on there as well, aren't they, that regularly put fish up.
I don't know. Does it have an inlet and an outlet? Is it a constant changeover of water, which keeps the oxygen up as well? I've never seen the place. So
a lot of these old sort of quays and wharfs that have had boat traffic over the years and pollution issues and stuff, a lot of them have those like air stones put in them, you know, where they've like constantly got moving. And I know the quays at Salford is exactly like that. There's a load of these like air bricks. It's got to help keep the fish moving in the winter. Carpfeed.com's got all the sort of latest catch reports, and is Crowy right? Is there more people fishing, or is it just the fact that lakes are better stocked? I mean, you know, if you've got
a combination of everything, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a lake now, I've spoke about it before, but you're going to keep, like, you know, the days of Raisbury having a handful of fish in 100 acres and bloody six people a year buying the ticket, you know, hardcore, as good as it was, as iconic as it was, as rewarding as it was, you know, to own a piece of land in that sort of area that's probably, I wouldn't even like to guess how much Raisbury's worth, but, you know, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million, I don't know, but, you know, to own that piece of land and to, you know, have it hardcore with you know, a dozen carp in there and maybe a 10 anglers if you're lucky, you know, paying, even if they pay a grand a year each, it's just improbable. It's just never going to happen again. Now, obviously, the reason why those lakes were the way that they were is because the company that owned them, which was CMEX, you know, formerly RMC, angling, they've already had the money for the lakes because they excavated them, dug them, and, you know, made their money off all the gravel and had to put them into some sort of wildlife nature thing as part of the planning permission. So, you know, that's what happened, is a lot of the gravel pits back in the 80s, 90s, 2000s were all owned by the company that excavated them. But I'm guessing that they probably couldn't sell it for a certain amount of years. I guess there was clauses when they dug it that they had to do stuff with it for the benefit of the local environment, and there were probably clauses in there as to when they could sell them. Obviously, they either decided, if there was no clauses, then they just decided they weren't making them any money and they sat on millions and millions of pounds worth of land that they can sell. You know, there were clauses and they couldn't sell up until a certain point. But either way, there's no coincidence that pretty much every gravel company that's excavated no longer operates a leisure sport division. You know, leisure sport was one of them. If you remember the Amy Roadstone that owned all the Oxford, that dug all the Oxford ones, they used to have a leisure division. You know, they used to lease the lakes and stuff for various different. They've all sold them off like everybody, you know, all the Cambridgeshire Waters, a lot of them, like your Fenn and Ferry Lagoon, they're all Amy Roadstone. Back in the day, Horseshoe, a lot of the Cotswold lakes. Or certainly then, when they owned these lakes, there was no money. And as we know now, if you are going to go and spend a few million quid on buying a complex or a piece of water, the way to get your money back is fill it full of carp and sell tickets for £800 a go. Seems to be the going way. So them days of a dozen fish and, you know, really sort of romantic low stock carp fishing, that's the thing of the past, I think. The only ones you're going to find like that are club waters, where the club's paying virtually no rental on the lease.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there is, I'm sure for those of them that sort of fishing, if you look hard enough, you're going to find it, and I'm sure there's still going to be special fish out there.
Nature reserves and, you know, places like that, getting onto a water that, you know, maybe hasn't previously been allowed to have fishing on it, and somebody gets permission, something like that. I think that's where, if you want that type of fishing, which is the sort of fishing we did. I mean, to be honest, if you wanted 40s, in the late 90s, you generally had to find those sort of places. You know, we didn't join Elstow 2 because it was full of fish. We, you know, I wouldn't have minded 50 extra carp in there, but you know, and the 240s, but we joined it because, you know, fish only got to £40 in the UK if they were in you know, if there was a lack of competition for food, and they weren't hammered. You know, so that's why they got that big. So in those days, obviously now, you know, people are breeding faster growing strains of fish, they're stocking them at bigger weights, feeding them up to a point, and it's changed the landscape.
Yeah, I don't think it will. We know it'll never go back, but that's a good thing with fishing. You just do the style of fishing that you enjoy and crack on.
Yeah, or go abroad. That seems to be my answer for the type of fishing that I want. Big open lakes, but even there, they're fairly well stocked. So, yes, interesting. Have you spotted anything on the net? Anything around?
Well, apart from what you've just mentioned, I can't look at the minute because it's a new phone. It's still updating all the apps. So, but off the top of my head, have you seen it's a new era for Carp World magazine.
Yes, yes. I know they're advertising for a new editor. So basically, Carp World was owned by the Paisleys, has been sold. I presume money's changed hands, and it's now being run by Carp Talk, based up in Yorkshire. Clifford family, Bev and Crowy works for them, obviously on Carp Talk, and Kevin Clifford, the mogul behind it, and they're advertising for an editor, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. I don't know, there's some pretty you know, big boots to fill there. So now, do you think you could ever be a magazine editor?
I think if I was motivated, yeah. I mean, thought about it in the past. I used to enjoy writing, but I'm pretty lazy, and it's a fairly involved job, I think. You know, I've known a few editors over the years. Excuse me. You know, and I've spoke to them about their role and job, and yeah, it looks pretty tough. Fair bit of travelling, I guess, travelling around. I think an editor's a sort of job that I think you're born to do. I think you need a unique slant on, you need your own personal slant on, you know, you've probably thought about it a lot. You haven't just said, oh, there's a job cropped up, I could do that. I think most editors probably had a very clear vision of how they think it should go for quite a lot of time before they actually got the job. You know, I'm making that up, but I just get that impression that they're quite opinionated people that have a vision in a certain way and have a lot to say. They want to get their opinion across in the carp scene.
What you just said perfectly described Tim Paisley was at the helm for a long, long time, and, you know, I used to enjoy his editorials, enjoyed his books. And it was well, I dare say it still is, you know, the top of the tree car magazine. I know on the odd occasion I get an article in there, it's always, it gives you the, how can I put it, yeah, a little ego boost, you know, always puts a smile on my face to see, you know, my little name in there with all the other big names who were
yes, in. Yeah, it's, it is a big deal. I think did I do one article, a series in Cartworld? I can't remember if I ever did or not, but it was certainly the, it was certainly the goal. Like, Cartworld was the best one, you know, there was a, there used to be a hierarchy of magazines, didn't there? I think, you know, most people's first article was in Big Carp, you know, that's the one that they're quite happy to print articles by unknown people, and a lot of people got their leg onto the writing scene from Big Carp. Advanced Carp Fishing was one of the sort of earlier ones. They were always on the lookout for up and coming people. I think like the ones that used to sell the most were Crafty Carper and Total Carp, which were sort of aimed at the entry level carpers. Have they both gone now, or is just one of them gone?
Crafty Carp has gone, Advanced has gone, I believe Total Carp is still around. Obviously Big Carp still plods on. You know, Carpology is there, that's carved out its own little niche with its different style. And then obviously we've got Cartworld there, the Good Read.
Yeah, so I think Total and Crafty, they were more, the sort of people that used to write in them were the people that catch a lot of fish, that fish the day ticket waters, you know, your Ian McMillans, Ian Poole used to be regular in those. You know, it's the guys that catch way more than we did, like fishing the low stock. Yeah, not hard at all. Yeah, I had a few pieces in Advanced. I'm sure I did do one piece in Cartworld. I did Crafty Carper once or twice as well, but yeah, I mean, I get messages all the time from people, you know, how do I get sponsored by a company, how do I get in magazines. You got some advice on that, Mark?
Forget about it, go out and enjoy your fishing and catch a boatload of fish. Yeah. Because if you start putting pressure on yourself, you're thinking, yeah, I need to be sponsored, I need to be attached to the latest Joe Bloggs Fred in the Shed bait company. That's not what it's about. It's about enjoyment with your friends and catching fish. And if you want to get into the magazine writing, it's not as easy as what it was. But there is lots of other ways. Look at how Carl and Alex have done it with the YouTube. That's another way. If you're good at blogging, you can do your own stuff online. There's quite a few different online magazines now who would welcome a piece of some fresh new keen angler. I believe Big Carp magazine will still consider articles from new and upcoming anglers. But don't make it a priority. The fishing is a priority, not... I'll tell you now why I started writing articles. It was back in Elstow 2 time. I'd done one before that. It was entitled Light Leads. It was published in Carp Fisher, the old Carp Society magazine, and I enjoyed reading magazines, so I just felt like doing one. But when it came to fishing Elstow, you know, I was skint in a crap job, and I wanted to try and supplement my fishing a little bit, which is why I started.
Yeah. As you said, you catch fish, you know. I never wrote to anybody and said I want to be in a magazine. You know, they came to me after I'd caught a few big fish or done something that stood out, and they were like, will you do a piece? You know, and that's generally most people I know. There's a couple of exceptions, but generally that's how it goes down. Do something significant or something that stands out, you know, be the first person to, I don't know, catch every carp in a session, or, you know, catch a brace of 40s in winter, or and just be consistent, and, you know, somebody will come knocking if that's what you desire. But, you know, let's not forget, there ain't nobody rich from fishing. Nobody. There is no exceptions. You know, I don't know how wealthy Terry Hearn is, but he's definitely the exception to the rule. As far as,
yeah,
and he still has to, you know, I've still seen him stood behind a shop counter at shows, you know, punting products and books and dynamite stands and, you know, the Empress stand, and, you know, he still has to go out and work for the, for these sponsorships.
Here's a question. If, you know, Terry Earn just come into his fishing now, do you think the same thing could be achieved? It was in a different era where you had all your low stock, you know, venues like Yateley had the mystique about it and the famous fish, and then obviously Raisbury, the Black Mirror, you know, Two Tone, and, you know, the bunch of other fish like the Causeway fish, and
I think,
you know, the rake of others. Even the Rotund Cambridgeshire one. Got to sneak that one in.
I think there is a couple of lakes. There's a couple of tickets you could get that if you're a good angler and you fish the right lake, then you probably could be famous within a year or two. And I think RK Leisure famous Jack the Net Ripper Horton. Horton is one of those lakes now where there's enough 40s and 50s in there that if you have a good season on there, you're going to be in the press every week with big fish. And Wellington Country Park's the same. If you secured a ticket on those two or three seasons in a row, and you had a desire for fame, then you probably could. It's a shortcut for sure. Outside of doing that, I don't know, you just got to be super consistent. Have you noticed, you know, I think Wazzy, they call him Mark Wazencroft. Have you seen him crop up on Facebook? He seems to have been living on the bank since the Christmas period. He looked like he was on St John's and was catching well. And I've seen him crop up with some fish from Wales yesterday or the day before. And damn, that's the other way, is if you keep seeing somebody's name in the press almost daily, catching 30s, 40s, whatever, like, people notice that. You know, obviously people knew Wazzy anyway. He'd fished farriers for years, and he's had a few good fish out there, and he's clearly a very good angler. But even though I knew him, I just keep seeing his face, catch. And you know, if you were, not saying he is, but if you were you know, young angler looking to get yourself known, then that's it, go and catch loads of fish. And and as long as you're literate, you can tell the story in a legible way, either via video or by the written word. Fucking dog will not sell today. Just on my lap, just keeps trying to knock the mic and eat the wire. As long as you're good at portraying, it's no good just catching fish either anymore. Companies are not after that. They're after promotion, people to sell the product. Not, I mean, have you ever made a fish post or posted a picture of your fish on social media and underneath put Tangy Squid doing the business, or its downfall was Scopex Squid? I've never felt the need to mention the bait in one. It feels wrong. Like, because we know that all baits catch. You know, I've caught consistently since I was a young kid on pretty much every bait I've ever used. Yes, some baits are better than others, but at the end of the day, none of us are bait experts. You know, when I was young and making my own boardies, it was no bait. You know, it was a 50-50 Richmouth mix. I'd get some fish, ground up fish meal from a different supplier, just mix a bit of that in, some sodium caseinate from somewhere else, some egg albumin to harden them up a bit, and then, you know, it'd be a different flavour each week depending on what was in the shop. And it's like made on I've got one in the cell nailed on homemade bait. Like, what a banger. There's a couple of sayings in carp angling that really annoy me at the minute. Banger, sell.
I think anything that has ever, future, past or present, includes the word pucker should just be abolished.
Well, thankfully we've got three.
Unless it's a pie.
Now we're through the pucker stage now, aren't we? Packer.
There's a bit of a link. I've just got Mark Wazencroft's Facebook on, and in the first post at the top, it's he shared bait tech carp scenes video. Here's a 30 pounder on the bank.
Yeah, what, him?
But, yeah. And we've got he shared Witchwood Cat's video, the 30-pounder swimming off. But he's doing it right, he's catching, and I love it. Every capture report he puts on, it's hashtag Jammy Dodger time.
Yeah.
So they're not quite as good as Jaffa Cakes, but I will give him credit for that one. Get on the Jammy Dodgers. Maybe that's his secret.
Say something else I saw on Cart Feed actually over the new year. Obviously this is the first show this year, and I feel like some of this stuff I've noticed for a little while. But yeah, do you see the lad that landed a 40 on his dad's rod on the monument?
For all the news, check out carpfeed.com.
Oh, the monument. I did see that, yeah. Fair play to the young lad.
That's another lake that seems to have been fishing fairly consistently all winter. Monument and Monument 2, which seems to be coming into its own. But yeah, a 12-year-old Oliver Stedman Wallis saw his dad head to the on-site tackle shop for supplies. He nipped to the shop for more leads. While he was away, young Oliver got a bite and landed an incredible 42-pound mirror by himself. His dad is holding the fish, though, and looks maybe it's a bit big for a 12-year-old. But what a fantastic result. A fish that's put on 14 pounds since the Monument 2 opened.
What was your PB when you were 12?
It was 11.25 pounds. I remember it well. I was actually 12, and it was from Texas.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I didn't even... Not sure if I'd even caught a carp by then.
Yeah, this was a fun. I don't know if I've told this story on the Carpcast before. Possible. So my dad was a social worker, worked for County Council in Macclesfield. I think he worked, forget where he worked, but anyway, wherever he worked, there was a pretty serious carp angler. One of the ones, do you remember Reedsmere back in the late 70s, early 80s.
I remember reading a lot about it with people like, Frank Warwick starting off on there and catching a lot, and a few other Northwest names.
Well, it was very hush. I think you could get on there fairly easy at the time. It was very hush-hush. I don't think the bites were that common, but it had 30 pounders in at the time, which were huge for the sort of late 70s, early 80s, especially for the Northwest. It was all, it was a lake that was talked about in hush, hush tones. Now, obviously, I was really young then, so I'm like 11 at this time, I think. Been fishing a couple of years and had just started catching I used to fish with a ledger, like sort of running lead, butt indicator, and like, a couple of bits of corn on like a size 12, size 10. We were catching bream up to 4 or 5 pound, small tench, small carp, like a pound or two, from a few different lakes that we fished. One of them was this Tegs Nose Reservoir. Anyway, every now and again, the butt indicator would whack up and you'd get into something heavier and it'd snap you up. You're fishing like 5 pound line straight through. And there was this serious carp angler that my dad knew. I don't even know his name, but he fished at Reeds. He fished on Reedsmere. He was one of the the guys in the know back then. My dad used to tell him about this, and he came in one day and gave me dad these boilers. Now, this is before you could buy boilers. There was no Richer for anything at the time. They were BCSG members only, and people in the know. They were like these strawberry boilers, or what I know now to be boilers. He gave about 25, 30 of them to my dad and went, tell your lad to get the heaviest line he's got, the biggest hook he's got. This was like pre-hair rig for the masses as well. So he was like, side hook it, put it out and tell him not to reel it in. That's what he told my dad to tell me. Tell him not to reel it in, leave it out. So the next time we went up to Tegs Nose, which is a reservoir quite high up in the, going towards the Peak District in near Macclesfield, flipped this out. I had a 9-foot sea rod that I'd got off my granddad, with whatever the sea line that was on this reel that was already on it, probably like 35 pound line or something, big thick wiry stuff. Put my normal running lead on it. I got a big hook, don't know how big it was. Flipped it out, which probably went about 3 rod lengths out in front of where I was. Put the rod on my normal rest, no indicator or anything. It was just like pointing up into the sky at 45 degrees. And I sat there, bored out of my head, because I couldn't reel it in and keep casting and all this stuff, because this guy had told me to leave it. So I'm sat with my dad, who's like a few yards down, and you know, watching his indicators and stuff because I'm bored. Next thing, this rod's gone in. I've just looked down, the rod's gone over, and I've run down anyway. Ended up landing this fish, which was more than double the size of any fish I'd ever caught before. I probably caught bream up to like 4.5-5 pounds, something like that, from the reservoirs we used to fish, Bosley Reservoir and Teg's Nose and stuff. Anyway, I got this fish in. It was a common way. We had to borrow the scales of somebody else. I think my little spring scales went up to 7 pound or 10 pound or something. It bottomed them out. So yeah, this guy a bit further down, we had to borrow his, and it was, I think it was 11.25 or 11.5 pound. Still got a picture of it, actually, this fish, like a common, which is a pretty big fish for the you know, the sort of places I fished in those days. And that was my PB for a good few years. I must have been 11, because I remember I was just starting high school. Just starting high school when that happened. I remember telling this lad that I got friendly with, Rory Griffiths. I remember telling him, was also a fisherman that fished up at Teg's Nose. I didn't know, yeah, and I met him when we started school. I remember telling him this story. We used to go up there quite a bit together, fishing after that. But yeah, it was one of those key moments, you know, in your fishing career, that just, it was quite a big deal, catching a fish way bigger than anything. And this guy, my dad told this guy what had happened, and I caught this 11 pound, and the guy went bent on him. He was like, started flapping and panicking, and obviously as a young kid, I'm like, Dad, get some more of them things, get some more of them strawberry things. And then every day he'd come home from work, I was like, did you ask him, can I get some more? And then he went a bit bent, obviously, because he probably realised what he'd done. Now he's got some young kid going about telling everybody about these things that were probably meant to be secret at the time, probably never expected me to catch anything. And I never got any more. And then a year or two later, you could buy the Richworth ready mounts, honey yucatans, I think, were my first ones. You remember them?
I do, yeah. I did two de fruities, honey yucatans. Small, I remember the first bag of boilies the first bag I bought was strawberry yoghurt flavour. I remember catching one or two from a place called the Willagarth, and I say, well, they were rock hard as well. You could do some damage in a boilie fight. Which happened quite often.
Well, we are looking forward to the Northern Anglia Show, 24th, 25th of February, and partner in the show, Reedy, Nick Maddox, who you may remember from last year when he caught the scarfish, or was it the year before last now? Caught the scarfish from Gravier's at 90-odd pound. I caught up with him just to tell us about what's going on in the show.
The Carpcast, in association with the Northern Angling Show, the North's biggest fishing event at Event City Manchester, 24th and 25th of February. For early entry and the cheapest tickets, visit northernanglingshow.co.uk.
I'd like to welcome the man from the Northern Angling Show, the guy that does all the graft to make all them tens of thousands of metres look good and semi-organised, with all the parking, the stress and everything. It's the main man, Reedy. Welcome to the Carpcast.
Yes, mate. How's it going? All right.
Yeah, not too bad. I'm just looking at this year's floor plan. Coming together nicely. Lots of green blocks everywhere. There's a few little spaces for all the keenies that may have not booked in yet. But, yeah, it's looking pretty sick.
Yeah, that's it. We've got some mega stands in this year. A lot of the stands from last year have gone bigger as well. The likes of sort of Ridge Monkey, Sticky Bait, Solar, and Spotted Fin as well. A lot of them have gone much bigger. So, we've got some impressive stands in there for this year. It's going to look good.
Yeah, they always had pretty good stands anyway. There was, especially that Spotted Fin one was new last year, wasn't it? They had the big blue stand, looked pretty smart. Sticky Baits always looked ridiculous. You can see it towering above everything. And a lot of the show, it's the effort that these companies are putting in, isn't it, to advertise
this
stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen it as well in the past, sort of certainly the last couple of years. A lot of the stands have upped their game, and they've realised that, you know, it's the effort that you do put in, make the stands look good, make it look impressive, and it draws people to them. So, yeah, it's good to see the people putting in the efforts. And, yeah, like you say, the Spotted Fin stand in particular, it was one that really took my eye last year. I know they've got some exciting stuff coming forward. They've got some new ranges of baits and stuff. So, yeah, they'll be using the show as a platform to launch their new ranges. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing what they've got this year in particular. Yeah.
And we've got the usual retailers where you can get all the bargains. Eric's Angling are there again, and they're a bit of a stalwart of the show scene. You know, that I remember when they were getting banned from shows for selling stuff too cheap because people had the hunt with them. So there's always bargains to be had. We've got Roddick Vale Royal as well. What other retailers have we got?
Yeah, that's it. We've got those two, as you mentioned, and then we've got a number of smaller ones that will be on sort of specific stands working with people. So I know Avid have got their own retailer in there, so have Solar, Tracker. They'll all be bringing people Signet as well. They've got someone to work with. And as well as some of the other stands, you can pick up stuff direct from, like your Corders, your DNA Baits and CC Moore and stuff like that. You can come and get that stuff direct from them. So, yeah, all the bargains all in one place, really.
Does it make you mad when you see comments on under the posts, Northern Angling Shop posts? You can't buy any stuff there, or get stuff cheaper in my local shop. Does it wind you up? Because it winds me up.
Yeah, it does. It does get me, and I just try to be as informative as possible. Like some of the guys, I mean, yeah, some stands are only there to display new ranges, or they'll be working with a retailer in the show. So it's a case of you just have to go to, like for instance, Nash. They don't sell direct on the stand. They work with Eric's next door, so you pop over. Same for JRC, Chubb and Gray's, and same for a lot of the stand, really. So if they do say, oh, we're not selling anything direct from the stand, just ask if they're working with a retailer in the show, or where can you get it from, and they'll soon point you in the right direction. But yeah, there is absolutely stacks of bargains to be picked up if you just go and ask the right people and go to the right stands.
Yeah, they're not making it hard for you to buy stuff. You know, if somebody's demoing something to you on the stand, like, usually the retailer has got it with them. I mean, that's why they work with the retailers. And if they haven't, it's because there isn't one in the country at the minute, and they're demoing something that's going to come out, you know, ready for the spring. So they've either got it there to sell, or nobody's got one in the country.
Yeah, that's generally the case, mate. You've hit the nail on the head there, definitely.
Yeah, and but it does frustrate me when I see those comments. Man, you can't buy anything, or my local shop sells it cheaper. Listen, Eric's were getting banned from shows because of how cheap they were selling stuff. You're telling me Joe Bloggs' shop down the road has got it cheaper than Eric's, that are buying literally millions of items at once to get the lowest prices, and then they're price matching pretty much anything. And then they're although I believe that practice has stopped a little bit now for all the manufacturers listening to this. Sorry, Kevin. Eric's don't discount anymore. Ever.
No, in fact, I don't remember him having a track record of it, to be honest. No,
never. So yeah, obviously there are loads of bargains to be had at the show. I mean, we've got some special guests to announce. Is there an official time and date we're going to be doing this?
There is, yeah. We're looking at the last week of January. We're just sort of dotting the I's and crossing the T's, as it were, just putting the final bits to the sort of stage times and the lineup in place. So, yeah, end of January, there'll be a big announcement, and you'll see that we've got some pretty special guests to add to the lineup for this year. But to be honest, even without the special guests, it's looking like one of it looks like another a fantastic lineup for us. We've got some people that haven't really done much on the main stage before. So, yeah. Looking forward to welcoming them.
And if we're going to tease a guest, we can say that one particular guest that hasn't been released yet is a household name and has never been to Northern Angling Show before. Is that as much as we can say?
I would say all three of the special guests that we've got to announce at the end are household names, as you say, and all three of them have never been to Northern Angling Show before. So yeah, NAS debuts all round for those three.
Absolutely monstrous. Should be fantastic. Yes, end of January then. We'll be doing that. If people can you pay on the door, mate?
There will be, yeah. Well, to be honest, actually, we are looking at how many tickets we are going to have available on the door this year. The pre-sales have been absolutely bananas. So, yeah, if you want to get in from 9 a.m. and you want to get the cheapest price, then I'd advise booking your tickets online via the website. And, yeah, as I say, there will be a limited number of tickets on the door. They do cost a little bit more, but, yeah, just to guarantee your entry, make sure you book in advance and get them nice and early.
Yeah, if you come on the door, you're in from 10 a.m. Is that correct? We do try and get people in 15, 20 minutes early if we've got the pre-sale queue down, don't we? But generally, it's officially 10, 10 a.m. If you want in from 9 a.m. there are loads and loads of VIP bundles as well. You can get them at northernanglingshow.co.uk, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's worth bearing in mind that to give us time to organise the bundles and the packages with the manufacturers that put them forward, we have to take them off sale a little bit before the show just so we can get everything organised and in place. So if you are looking to pick up one of the special offers, then they'll be off sale by the 31st of January. But yeah, like you just mentioned, Jamie, there's plenty to choose from. There's bait, clothing, PVA, there's all kinds of different bits and bobs that you can pick up for in with your ticket price.
Including a Carpcast bundle of hoodie and t-shirt and ticket for the bargain price of £40, is it, or £45? I can't remember.
I think it might even be, I think it is about £40 if I remember rightly, for your one.
Yeah, it basically works out. You get an extremely cheap Carpcast hoodie and t-shirt and you get your ticket for nothing. That's kind of how it works out. And you can pick either day, Saturday or Sunday. It's the 24th and 25th of February. Loads of new stands for this year. Heavy carp and course content as usual. And there is even a Carpcast theatre this year, which is looking fun. One of the three special guests that we haven't announced yet. One of them is going to be in the Carpcast Theatre. Just to give a little teaser, we're hosting an area. It's going to look like your living room, basically. It's going to be all nice and cosy with sofas and fires and stuff like that. And we're going to be interviewing some Carpy guests in there. So yeah, it's going to be next door to the lab, which is a practical demonstration area, which is hosted by Julian Cundiff and Joe Turnbull. Joe is bait expert. He'll even show you how to make your own goo. And Julian is going to be talking rigs and all stuff carpy, so they're both going to help you put more fish on the bank. They are demoing all day long, all the practice stuff, and there's guests in there too. And right next door to the Carpcast Theatre, hosted by myself and Mark. We've got the main stage as well, obviously. It's studded, star-studded, full of guests.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got some strong ones on there this year. So, is there any in particular that you're looking forward to seeing this year? Don't mention the special guest yet, obviously.
I always love seeing Desmond up there, Des Taylor, who is this week's guest, as you will already know. The usuals, to be honest, one of the things that impresses me, and I presume we're going to put a list out this year, but it's the guests. It's the well-known anglers that I've followed for 20, 30 years in some cases, that have an absolute wealth of knowledge, that are just at the show on various stands. And I think we should do a list of those this year, because, you know, you've got people like Sean Harrison there, you know, the guy's an absolute genius.
Absolutely. There's almost too many to list and to try and find out who's going to be there and what days and stuff like that. But like you say, you've got your Sean Harrisons, Ian Russells, the list goes on and on and on, that they all just feature on the sort of manufacturer stands. And yeah, you can go and meet them, speak to them, get your questions answered. So yeah, it's a lot more than just the guys that we have on the stage, for sure.
Yeah, I remember one of the first shows I ever went to, you know, as a keenie myself, and you're standing there, Rob Malin stood behind a stand selling books, you know, a guy that I'd followed for 20 odd years, you know, reading all his books. And there's Terry Earn stood behind another book stand selling books. It's just like, these people are just like shopkeepers almost, just there.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the who's who, isn't it? There, it's just everyone there all in one place. It's an opportunity not to be missed, certainly, if you want to come and meet those guys.
Event City Manchester, which is right at the back of the Trafford Centre. There's a brand new hotel built. If you're travelling and need some accommodation, you can stay right next door now, walking distance away from the venue. It's the 24th, 25th of February. You can pay on the door, or you can get tickets in advance from northernanglingshow.co.uk. You got anything else to add this year?
No, well, I think that's it until we get the sort of special guest announcements together. As I say, they're forthcoming, so yeah, that's the next big bit of info we've got to release. But any other questions or any other stuff you want to find out, visit the website. We've got loads on there. It shows you what we've confirmed for the stage so far, and it's got all the tickets, offers, everything you need is pretty much on the website or on the Facebook page.
Fantastic. We'll speak soon.
Perfect. Good to catch up with you, mate. Take it easy.
The Carpcast, in association with the Northern Angling Show, the North's biggest fishing event at Event City Manchester, 24th and 25th of February. For early entry and the cheapest tickets, visit northernanglingshow.co.uk.
So big thank you to Nick Maddox. I'm sure there'll be more updates on the NAS as we get closer. We'll get Nick on when we announce our three very special guests.
Three.
I can tell you one of them has been a Carpcast guest, probably one of our most favourites. There are other Carpcast guests on the lineup already. Frank Warwick's been announced, going to be at the show, amongst others. And today's guest, Des Taylor, he's also at the Northern Angling Show. But yeah, we've got two others that are celebrities, household names, that have never previously attended the show. So, yes, you will be seeing them in Manchester on the 24th, 25th of Feb. Something else, our friends at Carp Feed have actually just in the last few minutes put a post up about this, but it's on my list to talk about anyway because it's been creating a bit of a shitstorm. Talking of shitstorm, the dog's on my knee and he stinks. Just as I said shitstorm, it's floating up. It's creating a bit of
is it silent? Is it sneaking him out or is it proper raspers?
Yeah, it's just a puff usually. I mean, when you sat with him on the sofa, you just hear it every now and again go psh. just you can hear the air coming out, but I've got headphones on, so I can't hear anything at the minute. But as usual, a social media storm when something's a little bit different in fishing. You know, the vast majority of the negative social media angling brigade, the Carpy Justice Warriors, as you like to call them, Mark.
Yeah.
Anything looks slightly different, it's so and so's out to rip us off. You know, insert company name here, Danny Fairbrass. Kevin Nash, you know, there are something else to fleece our money out of our pockets, you know. Well, first of all, in relation to that, it is not compulsory. You do not have to buy things that are advertised. It's your choice as a consumer. But moaning about it as your default mechanism because something's slightly different and you know better about something you've never seen, clapped eyes on, or held in your hand, if you have a judgmental negative opinion on that, then you're probably great fun at parties, but stay off my social media. The this week's controversy is the new Nash claw hooks. Have you seen those?
I have, yes. Got rather a curious kind of angled bend. It looks like they've been bent around a 50 pence piece.
Yeah,
I think, for want of a better description. But yeah, I saw a lot of the...
They do look a bit funky.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen the pattern. I take interest in hooks. Is something I take... I scrutinise a lot in my own fishing. I'm very particular about what I use. So anything new comes out, I'm going to have a look. And I've got to be honest, I've seen the Nash claw hooks. And, you know, this is only me. It doesn't look like a hook that I will be incorporating into my fishing. Having said that, I don't feel like I need to go on social media and tell everybody that, because a lot of people, especially if they like the wide gate type patterns, will get some good use out of this hook. Although some of the comments, I just want to address, I've seen several people mentioning bent hooks should be banned, as in, you know, the bent hook from, you know, when was it, like early 90s, 80s even?
Yeah.
Which was absolutely nothing like this. So if you said that, go do a little bit of research. The original bent hook that was causing all the damage on lakes like Harefield and Savvy back in the day was a long shank fly fishing nymph hook, and halfway down the shank that was bent.
Yeah.
Not round the bend itself.
No, the bend, you know, having a more of an angle on the U bit of the hook is not a bent hook. It's you know, the hook acts physically exactly the same way as a hook. Most of the comments that's just showing somebody's ignorance. But most of the comments I've seen are just about you know, it should be weaker. Mark Vuzin has just been interviewed by Tom at Carpfeed, and we can actually read his own words. Now, I've spoke to Mark about this. We've actually had Mark on the show, haven't we? Pinpoint were a sponsor of the Carpcast for a little while, and we did an edition some months back, a year or so ago, called Frank Warwick and the Germans, which the Germans was Mark Mark Vosen, and one, I forget his name now, but Mark came across with one of his good fishing pals, and I interviewed them on a Carpcast about the German scene, and we did speak about pinpoint hooks there. And obviously since then, Mark Pinpoint have teamed up with Nash. Now Mark is a hook expert, and he's helped design this new range for Nash, and obviously the Pinpoint sharpening. I know Nash are trying to do a range of hand sharpened hooks at some point if they can. It's not been feasible at the minute, but obviously they've bought Pinpoint and they've rebranded all the sharpening equipment and stuff, so it's now the brand is called Nash Pinpoint. They've done a deal, and I've spoke to Mark about the thinking behind these claw hooks, and he does say yes, this bend in the U-bit will weaken the hook, but the hook is stronger. He's done all the tests, and the hook is stronger in the first place than normal hooks. So with this bend, it's exactly the same strength as the previous hooks, because there's advancements in materials. So in his own words, what's the thinking behind the claw? Nothing on these hooks is coincidence. Wire angles, wire size, angle, size of the eye, length of the point, placement of the barb, everything was tested in regards to physics and the purple of the individual palant. The claw is basically still a wide gape hook, which, as you said, Mark, the most obvious use for it is for the people that like the wide gape hooks. I exclusively used, until the Twisters came out, I exclusively used wide gape hooks for years. It was perfect for pop-up rigs, perfect for my my bottom bait rigs, knotless, not tight rigs. But what Mark says is, as we were able to increase strength so dramatically, we were able to play around with the shape, so that when tested in the manufacturer's labs, which they did over in Japan, I know they were using ballistic gel to imitate flesh, it resulted in way less movement as the flesh gets compressed in the bend. Imagine you put a hook through a piece of paper and pull on it, it would cut through that sheet easily. If you fold that sheet of paper a few times and repeat, the outcome will be different, as you would have to apply much more pressure to get the hook to cut through multiple layers. This results in less damage and less lost fish. So saying you're going to lose less here, and it's going to damage the mouth less. The decrease in strength because of the kink is barely measurable, but the increase in fish safety and fish on the bank certainly is. The general shape is one of a wide gape hook, and he's very slightly beat the point, which I personally don't like, but it is very subtle, so I'm not sure it would affect me not to use it. Many wide gape hands have a very aggressive beat point that nearly close the gape. The point of on the claw is it's beaked enough to protect it when fishing over gravel, but straight enough to keep its full hooking potential. So I like that.
I'm looking at the claw now. I dare say a few strokes with a sharpening file, and for all intents and purposes, it will be a straight point.
Yeah, very much.
If you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah, I like the look of the long shank twist. Well, have you got anything else to say about the claw?
Not really about the claw, though. They're doing a new floater claw as well. And just the shape of the hook, I can see that being very handy. But you just scroll down, the new long shank twister. Now, this hook does get me excited, because I'm a massive fan of the twister and similar patterns. Also, before I went onto the twister, back in the Elstow and St. Ives days, I used almost exclusively the long shank hooks that Corder and then ESP brought out.
I did
so
before the twisters.
Combination of the two, so yeah. I will be making sure a few of these find their way into my tackle box and tying them up.
Yeah, very much. Something else that struck controversy, before I got ill, I did troll a few people's trolls, people making dumb comments. But did you see the gyro hooks, which is basically a Fang X with a ring swivel on, permanently fixed to the eye?
Oh, yeah. I'd say that is one of several things, including these pinpoint hooks and the sharpening tools that, I said we need in the shop at work because of the popularity of the Ronnie rig at the minute. They're perfect.
And yes,
as I've seen on some of the comments, they also are far from new. I remember Gold Label tackled doing them years ago.
Yes, yeah, the Terry Eustace Gold Label, Carp Horror's Nailers, released were hooked. I ended up having a debate on somebody's post, just one of the usual knockers that just came out and slagged them off. Some people had picked a price out of the sky.
Why did you get involved?
Just every now and again, I want to make somebody look, show them up for the ridiculous comment that they have. This particular guy makes rigs, so he's invested anyway. He sells ready-made Ronnie rigs for people and various other rigs. So
then he should be buying a load of these.
the most obvious comment about them is, you can't reuse them. Obviously, with the normal quick change stuff, you can, just change your hook. But to be honest, by the time with those, especially the smaller ones, the quick change things, by the time you've got your shrink tubing back off it and you've opened out the quick change bit to change it, it's knackered anyway. And if you were changing the hook anyway, then you were going to change the quick change swivel as well. So I don't really see the difference, and the fact that we have got sharpening equipment to touch hooks up, my hooks last a long time. And I know when we had Kevin on the Christmas New Year edition, he did mention these hooks. He teased him a little bit, and I'm sure he told me either on air or off air there's going to be five in a packet. And to be honest, a packet of five hooks is going to last me a month or two, because I've got tight in my old age, and back in the days when we were fishing low stock hardcore lakes, I never cast a rig out twice. The days of St. Ives and those sort of lakes, if I miscast it, it never hit the bottom. I'd reeled it in before it had hit the bottom, and I'd obviously check it all, recast it again. That rig would then stay out for the night, and there'd be a new rig going out the next day. I would never recast that hook. Now, obviously, in the everybody's got files and stones and sharpening gear and whatever in their armory now. I've stopped doing that because I can get that hook, on day two and day three, on the following session, the week after that, I can get it as good as it was on the very first day. And that's without sharpening it and taking it to a needle point. That's just touching it up with the stones. Not that I'm fussed about saving money on hooks, but it's hook link material, really. I've used the original PB jelly wire, of which I'm down to probably my last meter and a half, 2 meters now. I've had these spools.
You're now using 3-inch rigs.
Exactly, yeah. The longer I can use that hook link, the better, because there is no more. It's not the same as it was. I mean, I've got to be honest, I haven't tested the latest one that PB are doing. I need to speak to Jack Meehan and his dad to have a good look at it. But I'd be surprised if it's the same. I've heard it's not, but I will know as soon as I look at it. But yeah, so I mean, more than trying to save the hook, I've been trying to not reuse the hook link more than anything. But I don't know. I quite like the idea of these. I'll certainly use them, I think. I don't see. Yes, points can go over and stuff, but usually you can sort them out with a file anyway. So I don't see any problem whatsoever. And it's obviously stronger than a quick change swivel. Quick change swivels were not designed to be used in Ronnie rigs. They weren't designed to be used, to force through the eye of a hook, opened out slightly, bitten back down together and shrink tube. They weren't designed for that. So, we've kind of bastardized them, haven't we? So. Yeah, I like the ideas of these gyros. Yeah. How sharp are the new hooks? These hooks are as close to a hand sharpened hook as I dared to push it without making them a one hook per cast. Which is obviously like everything, isn't it? We spoke about it. It's a balance. You can make a hook the sharpest hook on the market, but you probably can't cast it out twice because the point will just go over. So you need a balance, don't you, to being durable and super sharp. I feel the market for these mega sharp hooks that I sharpened under a microscope is very small compared to overall hook sales. Don't get me wrong, I sold tons and made a good living from it, but in comparison to the numbers Nash are selling, it's a tiny fraction. So yeah, they've tried to make the sharpest hook they can that's durable, which I like. I think there's new material. There's a bit in this interview about how the collaboration came about with Kevin and Alan. Very interested. Head over to carpfeed.com and you can have a look at this article that's just gone up now and learn about a bit about Mark. If you want to know more about Mark, there is a YouTube video that Alan's interviewed Mark Vosen that's knocking around at the minute that's come. He interviewed him in the lodge, which is on Churchlake, which is exactly where I interviewed him on Frank Warwick and Z German's episode of the Carpcast. But yeah, I'm interested to see I'm happy using the normal twists and stuff out the packet, and these are supposed to be sharper, so I know it's a new material as well. I think they're lighter, these hooks, so yes, I'm very interested to see them. The VIP Carp Holidays is flying at the minute, Mark. We have many
jolly good
many bookings for next year. VIPcarpholidays.com. Saint Armand Leisure, which as you will know, quite a few of our Carpcast listeners have visited there. It's a farmhouse that sleeps up to 10 people. There's games room in there. You got your own private lake, which is a hauling lake. You know, you're going to catch 10 fish a day, up to 50 pound. Farmhouse, I think there's four double bedrooms. It's got like big open plan kitchen, you know, the big Arga type cookers, fires, separate barns for drying your gear out. It's games rooms with like table tennis tables and stuff. Facilities are amazing for up to two families on holiday. It's only 950 quid for 7 days, near Limoges, so it's in a nice warm part of France. And there are still availabilities for the summer holidays next year, 2018. So VIPcarpholidays.com is where you can book that. It's an extremely cheap holiday for two families, 950 quid for the week. That gets you two adults, two fishing anglers and two non-fishing anglers, and you can add extra people on top for £100 and £150 respectively. But yes, you get six or eight of you in there. It's a very cheap holiday and fantastic facilities. I know the River Lots that we're also booking, I know that's extremely busy for next year. We're looking at 2019 really for the bookings there, but St. Armand Leisure you can get on this year. There is availability. And episode 60 or something, we had a live on the bank from St. Armand. I think it was Ben, one of our Carpcast listeners, actually recorded it.
Episode 46 with Steve Briggs seems to ring a bell, although don't quote me on that if I'm wrong.
Yes, you're right, it was the Steve Briggs episode. Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. So check that one out if you want to know more info. Head over to VIPcarpholidays.com, where you can also see the Slovenia and Croatia and Lake Bled trips that I'm running this year. We've got lots and lots of bookings, but we can take two groups of up to eight people per week. So we can. There's only one week, I think, that we can't take anybody, which is in May. But pretty much we can accommodate anybody. We can do bespoke holidays. If you want to fish for 11 days and you want to fish two different lakes or three different lakes, then we can work a holiday around you. All you need to do is to get in touch on there. And yeah, if you want to discover Slovenia or Croatia or both, you know, you can do 3 or 4 days in Slovenia and then we can head up to Croatia for 3 or 4 days if you wish. We can work a holiday exactly around you. We can cater for non-fishing guests as well. If you want to do some exploring of Croatia, see the scenery in Slovenia with your missus or whatever, we can arrange entertainment for your missus via my partner Rachel, who's extremely friendly, is happy to take people out sightseeing while the lads do a bit of fishing. Or obviously we can cater for your lovely lady on the bank as well. We can just get her own bivvies, bed chairs, and then she can do the camping side of it. The scenery is stunning, the fishing is amazing, they're all well stocked, we have a number of lakes. And I highly recommend it. And I will be over there myself all summer, along with Gasper, who is European angler extraordinaire. We do everything for you. You can fly over there. We'll pick you up from the airport and do everything that you need. VIPcarpholidays.com. And yeah, get yourself over. You will be going back every year, I guarantee it. I absolutely fell in love with the place the first time I went. By far the best place I've ever been. VIPcarpholidays.com. Shall we get Desmond in?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one.
He's extremely opinionated. He's a good old guy, been around for ages. Let's welcome Mr. Des Taylor. I'd like to welcome a stalwart of the fishing community, somebody that's been writing in Angling Times for what seemed like a lifetime from when I was a kid. He's not frightened of an opinion or two and seems to spend most of his days on a boat on the river now. So I would like to give a big Carpcast welcome to Mr. Des Taylor. How are we doing, pal?
Oh, fine, mate. Fine. Honoured to be asked. Still wanting to be sort of heard at 66. It's really good. You know, it's full of young lads, especially the carp scene, and then to be asked on here is a great honour. Thanks a lot, mate.
Well, you're very welcome. First of all, thank you for taking the time out. I know I tried getting hold of you yesterday, and you're out on the river again. Does that seem to be most of your life these days, drifting in the boat, catching sort of all species?
No, not really. No. I do all kinds of fishing, you know, I'm fishing all the time, but I don't fish with any species a lot. You know, I probably fish sometimes 4 or 5 days a week, but I could be bird fishing on the boat, I could be chub fishing, and I spend still quite a lot of time carp fishing, especially in the summer, in the autumn. I still, you know, the last 12 months, I certainly haven't had a 30, but I've probably had 25, 20s, up wow. to 25, I think I've 4 or 5 over 25, beautiful commons, nice little pool. I enjoy fishing on the surface or on the bottom. So, I fish for everything, Jamie, but I don't fish for anything a lot of time because I'm an all-rounder.
Yeah. Do you, is it the West Midlands you still live?
I live in Kidderminster now. I lived in Bewley for 30-odd years. I'm a backcountry guy originally to the west of Birmingham, and I still live there, and I still, you know, sort of fish the Severn a lot, and the local lakes.
So, Kidderminster, that's, is that more towards Stratford sort of way?
No, it's just south and west of Wolverhampton, really. You know, you're sort of 40 minutes away from the Welsh border. It's to the west of the Midlands. We're only sort of about, I don't know, 15 miles out of Birmingham, but we're on the west side. My house is probably about a mile and a half now. I've recently moved in a bungalow, and it's about a mile and a half from the river. So I'm right in the middle. I'm only an hour and a half from Oxford, the Oxford gravel pits. I'm only an hour from the Shropshire, Cheshire Meres, really. So it's a nice place to live, Jamie. I'm sort of handy for all kinds of fishing.
Yeah, I had it in my head that the Avon would be the nearest river, but it's the Severn, is it, I guess, then?
No, it's the River Severn.
Right, and is there any carp in there these days, in the Severn?
Yeah, there is. There's a lot. There's always been a head of carp, and a lot of people fish for them around Hull Fleet and Stourport. But with the massive floods that we've had over the last few years, Jamie, what's happened is a lot of those local pools to the river had got lots of carp in, and, you know, they overflowed, And the carp are the first to leave a pool, as you well know. Yeah. And they run with a flow. You only need, you know, a foot of water. There was a water at Kea Park that went into the River Teme. There was about, I think, 60 or 70 fish in there that people were growing on to put into the main lake. And they got to about 10 pounds. And I think there was only about a foot of water went over the dam in the flood. All gone. They all went into a little stream called Wire Brook. They all went in the Teme, and now they're all in the Severn. So I think there's a lot more carp in there than people imagine. And I think quite a lot of big carp smash the barbel angle. But when they say they've had a big carp, a big barbel, I don't think some of them are big barbel. I think they're bloody big big carp, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing a video of you when I was a kid, carp fishing on Cuttle Mill. Was that a place that you visited a lot back in the day?
Yeah, that was 30 odd years ago, and you know, I made a two videos up there, and it was great fun. And that's a long, long time ago. We make pipe videos on Thor Park, and we made the carp videos on Cuttle Mill. It was great times. And, you know, the amount of people now that said, you know, and it really is an honour for me to hear them say, I really got into carp fishing when I bought your DVD, or I got into pike fishing when I bought your DVD. And I go, that's 35 years ago. And they say, yeah, it got us into fishing. So, you know, that's really nice. It makes me feel good that.
You were always a guy to look up to when I was young. You had when did you first start writing for Angling Times? I mean, that's where I really remember you.
Well, it's just nearly 30 years now. I think I've done 28 years. I think it was 1986 or something like that. Something when I first started. It's nearly 30 years ago. I think it's 28 years now. So I've been writing an awful long time. And in those days, if you were in Angling Times, everybody knew you. There was the Angler's Mail, the Angling Times. I think there was one monthly, and that's it. I mean, there wasn't the carp magazines as there is now. And to be honest, it was just part of the year to be carp fishing. But now, you know, as we well know, you know, people sort of, that's all they do. I remember even only 30 years ago, you know, that, you know, it was almost class to go winter fishing for carp. You were a maniac. You just say they were impossible to catch. You know, it was a waste of time. And yet now, you know, I mean, some of the best fishing you can have, especially for big fish, is in the winter.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's got a lot more comfortable these days. I'm guessing you remember the days when, you know, we had to adapt equipment to suit, you know, different things. You must have seen the evolution of fishing tackle, you know, all fishing tackle, from, you know, the introduction of carbon in poles and all sorts. You must have seen it come along a lot in 30 years.
It's incredible. It really is. And I embrace it. The problem with people my age is they say, you know, it's all been ruined. And I say, what's been ruined? You know, it's a progress. I remember saying to John Wilson, who said that, you know, he'd never buy a bivvy or a bed chair. You know, fishing shouldn't be going along that line. And I said, well, you still don't drive an A40 car, do you, or an A35 van? You know, so you can't expect, you know, to be using cane rods now or glass. You know, you can't keep it in a cocoon. And to be honest, when I'm out carping, oh, I got the heaters, I've got the bed chairs, I've got me Nash, you know, sleep system, Titans and all that, you know. Christ, it's fantastic. You know, why not have, I mean, when I go for a week in France, you know, it's like moving home. I love it. You know, I got my little TV, my radio. I love it. And I hate that snobbery in fishing. I have to laugh sometimes when the river angler, the barbel anglers, will condemn carp anglers and say, oh, fishing for mud pigs under your bivvy and all that. And yet, you know, when you see a lot of the barbel anglers on the River Trent or whatever, they're actually, the only difference is they have the rod stuck up in the air instead of the rod down. You know, they use the same bait, the same buzzers, the same bivvies, and yet they say, oh, I don't like carp fishing. I say, well, you are really carp fishing.
do you think the attraction, or one of the attractions of carp fishing, is the camping side of it? I mean, it's not just fishing, is it? It is being out there for a day or two at a time, seeing it go dark. You know, it was always exciting at night for me as a kid. You know, as soon as it went dark, that's when the magic happened, you know?
Well, exactly. I mean, what's better, you know, than, you know, you and your mate, or you and your two mates out a week away, you know, not being stupid and getting drunk at a stump, but having a couple of beers at night and talking the usual rubbish that blokes talk about. And, you know, it's absolutely great. I really do enjoy that side. Yes, I do enjoy probably grailing fishing on my own, you know, wading out in the stream for a few hours. But, you know, I equally enjoy, you know, being out for a couple of nights. You know, I absolutely love being in the big when it's absolutely piddling down a rain. There's something magical. You think, oh, I hope I don't get a run now. But you feel, you know, you're in your sleeping bag, and, you know, you get this deep, and you think, oh, no, please, not now. There's something magical about being warm in a bivvy. It almost takes you back to your childhood, doesn't it? You know, in bed when you were a kid and pulling the clothes over your head and being nice and snug. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's talking of something that looks snug. I always see videos of you, and it looks like you've got a nice little tackle den or something in the is it in your garage or in your garden or something? It looks like you've got like a nice fishy room.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I've always had a fishy room, but this last house we just moved into 8 months ago, we dropped them out of the bedroom down, and I said, well, instead of, you know, having numerous bedrooms, because it's only just me and Maggie May now, so what do we need those for? All the kids have got their own houses, etc. So, you know, I've got this tattle den that I'm actually sitting in now. I've got memorabilia from all around the world, from shark fishing to pike fishing to carp fishing. And it's great to be sitting here and write articles. I'm writing a book now, and it's just great. It's really nice, especially you get a couple of mates around and we have a beer, and it's actually been like in a wooden bivvy. Instead of being fishing, we're just talking crap in the cattle deck. You know? You can swear and drink. You can be men, you know, rather than, you know, being stuck in the house and the missus being upset by all the language and the passing of wind, etc.
So is it in you did it in the shed, or is it in the house?
No, it's at the bottom of the garden. I had a big like summer house built, and I got it.
Right.
I got it insulated and plastered, and you know, some spotlights in, and my computers in, and all my bits and pieces, pictures, and all everything to do with my fishing except my tattle. I mean, I've got a nice little table in here where I tie my rigs, and I've got sort of on the table, I've got, you know, sort of things marked out like tope traces, pike traces, carp traces, etc. So I've got it all laid on there, and all my bits and pieces. So I tend to tie all my rigs in here, but I've not got my tattle in here. I've got my tattle in another place where I keep my tattle with reels, etc. I wouldn't get it all in here.
Yeah. So it's literally just a creative room, I guess. You say you're writing a book. What's the book?
It's just a nice place to be. It's just a nice place to sit. You know, I'm sitting here now, and I'm feeling really, you know, for something like this, you know, I'm looking at, you know, sort of pictures of birds, looking at pictures of fish, and I'm looking at things that, you know, from around the world, and I feel nice and relaxed talking to you. It's a nice atmosphere to do things like this in.
Fantastic. You said you're writing a book. How many have you written over the years, and what's this one about?
Well, I've been in quite a few books, but I've only done sort of, I think it's three that I've actually done myself. This one is The Ramblings of a River Angler. But I hope over the years now that as I get older, there's still a few books in me. And as I slow down on fishing, but I suppose eventually I will, you know, there's still some books in me. So perhaps it'll be The Ramblings of a Stillwater Angler, The Ramblings of a Carp Angler. I don't know. I'm hoping to make a bit of a, you know, a series of books. And, you know, I've got some books in me and I've got some tales to tell. So, you know, this one's The Ramblings of a River Angler, which is just about, as it says on the tin, you know, the ramblings of me talking about different species and hot subjects like otters and things like that, all sorts of things.
I wanted to discuss, you know, your stance on otters is quite strong. You're very outspoken about it. It's something that's affecting rivers, lakes, even canals. I've seen this week now, the otters seem to have moved in. Do you think there's? I read a post the other day that you put up. You were quoting somebody used to work for the EA. Do you think there's an actual conspiracy going down?
I don't know what to say yet, Jamie. All I would say is that if what Keith Williams has said is only 50% right, and I do firmly believe that, I've known Keith for a number of years, it'll probably be 100%. If it's only 50%, then some people in the EA really need to look out, because they will be in serious trouble. Because what's actually happened is that, you know, the consultancy with angling has been nil about otters. They were let out there. And let's just get one thing. Let's get one thing right from the start, Jamie. I actually like otters. When they were a rare apex creature, I had a photo in my other house in the hallway. As any of my friends will tell you, the first picture you came to was two. Peter Mead, the famous chub angler, gave me the photo years ago. It was a photo of two otters, sort of on their back legs standing up, and it was. I just loved otters. You know, they were an excellent predator, an apex predator, but they were very rare, and that was okay. But now they've been let out in such numbers, and of course, without hunting, without culling, they've absolutely gone wild, especially in the environment now, that when they were very rare, you know, it just so happened that we built these commercial fisheries, whether they be match fisheries, or whether they do the right likes of Rob Howes' waters, you know, it was like building for otters, a load of McDonald's with fish waiting for them. And that's what's happened. And we've now reached a point where one of the otter organisations has actually admitted that there wasn't enough consultation made and mistakes have been made. The thing that's got me now, Jamie, is, and I talked to Mark Lloyd about this, and one of the reasons I fell out with the Angling Trust and come off as an ambassador is that now they've said that, and now we know there's too many. It's no good drawing a line, Jamie. It's no good saying, right, well, we'll just draw a line. We won't put any more out there or whatever. You know, we won't stock any. We won't let any more otters. There are too many.
Yeah.
There is. I'm disappointed in the RSPB, really disappointed, when you consider that the last few years they've been putting fences up around their sites. Now, either foxes and badgers have got a taste for birds that they haven't done over the last few years, or otters are getting in, which I know they are, and the RSPB are fencing in. But they will not say anything against an otter. They're frightened to say anything against it, as everyone is. I ain't frightened to say it. You know, that you know, bird life on the Severn. None of, you know, you've got to remember is that if you've got a carp fishery, they won't only eat your carp, they'll eat your birds, they'll eat your, you know, the marginal birds like mallards or water rail or dipper. Birds like this, hey, just fits in an otter's mouth perfect.
Yeah, why do you think there is so much protection? I mean, I saw the UK Wild Otter Trust statement that Dave wrote. We had Dave on the show as well, and Dave, to be honest, has been meeting with fishery owners, been meeting with lakes. He's seen firsthand the evidence. He's also seen, you know, a big carp on the bank and the love that sort of goes into it, how we treat them, the excitement of the people there. So he totally gets it. And, you know, he's the guy that came out and said, yes, there wasn't any research done. It is an issue and we need to work together. So, I mean, obviously that's fantastic that, you know, the chairman of the Wild Otter Trust is saying all this stuff. But as he admitted, he said there is plenty in England now, but because it's a European strain of otter that's protected and all countries in Europe certain countries are still quite low. He said there'll never be a cull or anything, you know, that, that this is not going to happen. So we
I don't think you can say that. I really don't. You know, I think people would have said that about rabbits or foxes or badgers or whatever. You know, there comes a point, human life, human jobs are much more important than the numbers of otters in this country. You know, we want otters in the country, yes, and we want numbers on them, we want them to be safe, and we want them to be protected. But when they get to such a point, you know, how come, you know, fairy animals, lovely little animals like Bambi, the deer, rabbits, crows, there's, I can name, you know, badgers, all sorts of creatures, you know, are culled if they become a pest. Look at what the RSPB did in on one of the islands of Scotland. You know, the rats were eating the guillemot eggs. They didn't cull the rat. Now, okay, you say they're a rat. You know, there will be rat societies. There will be people that love rats. there really will be. Yeah. And I tell you, they didn't cull them. They eradicated them. So there wasn't one rat on the island.
Yeah.
Now, isn't it funny that they can do that, and yet we can't make it safe for fisheries in this country?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think the I don't know where the problem is, but it sounds to me from that last post you made that maybe there is some sort of cover up going down. If the angling authorities were not consulted when the otters were released, I think it was the early 80s, wasn't it, when they started being released, and onwards. If nobody was consulted, and then when it was apparent that there was an issue, that there was going to be a problem, and people were told they couldn't talk about it, you know, from within the EA, I mean, then that's a cover-up, isn't it, surely? I mean, what else would you call it?
Yeah, that's right. It was going to be the biggest stumbling block, and they know angling is weak. The EA, I mean, we're in bed with the EA. The Angling Trust, in with the, you know, the Angling Trust, wages are paid partly by the EA. You know, we pay our license to the EA. We're actually in bed with someone that doesn't look after us that well.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree.
I remember going to a meeting only a year ago, and one of the main guys in the EA that was there, he said, "I don't know what you're on about, otters. I absolutely enjoy walking down the river from my house and seeing an otter." He said, "Yes, I see the very odd barbel and the odd chub on the bank, but that doesn't outweigh actually seeing an otter." This is an EA guy walking down a stretch of river near Shrewsbury, where, now, if he can see one every now and then, let me tell you, every day they will be taken, because although they'll leave the body on the bank, it's took away by chub, by fox, badgers, rats, etc. So there's not much left. There might be the odd scales left. So if he's seeing one a week or one a month, every night fish are being taken. And this is an EA guy saying, there's not that much trouble. And we've even got to the point now that in the Angling Trust, we've got hierarchy in there, you know, that you know, Pete Redding has only said he doesn't think there's a problem. They eat crayfish. They eat mussels. You know, he doesn't think they eat fish.
Well, I mean, that's not even up for debate. We, as I said, we had Dave on from the UK Wild Otter Trust, who said, you know, the exact opposite. Yes, they will eat these other things, but they'll also take the easiest source of aminos and everything else that they need. And it, currently, that's carp. They'll eat eels as a first choice if there's plenty of eels. But as you probably know, we've lost 90% of the UK eel population. For one reason and another, and the next thing they're going to eat is the carp, carp, barbel, and obviously bird life as well. Yes. So I mean, you know, this is the chairman of the Otter Trust saying it. So you know, it's not like it's up for debate, is it? It's, you know, this is a guy that's an expert.
The funny part about it is, so one of the guys from the trust said that. They couldn't, you know, how could they carry a carp? You know, I've actually witnessed, a mate of mine had a water, and we were actually witnessing 30 and 40, this is not hearsay, this is me physically have seen them, that otters have pulled 30 and 40 pound carp from out the water, pulled them out, ate the heart or the, you know, the offal, and just left them. That's a 40 pound fish. But what people don't realize is that, you know, some of these male otters are 20, 22, 24, 26 pound in weight. They're a big old creature.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, they're incapacitating them in the water. You know, they go for the jugular because that's where all the, you know, where basically the, as you said, the offal, the intestines, the, you know, the heart, liver, all the bits that are rich with the nutrient that they need. You know, that's why they only eat that bit. They take the bite out of it, and that's it. The fish is limp. Then they can do whatever they want with it. It's not hard to drag something in water, is it, once it's dead or pretty much dead? So, I mean, it's not for debate. They've had 50-pound carp, the otters. You know, they're pretty much wiped out. Certain lakes in the Cotswold Water Park, you know, big heads of 30s and 40s. So it's not
can
like
you
it's...
Imagine now, can you imagine now, the likes of yourself who are a big carp angler, going to it, you know, it's bad enough thinking, am I in the right swim? Am I on the at the right end of the lake? You know, you're on a 200-acre gravel pit or a 100-acre gravel pit. Am I on the right end? Have I got the right bait? Blah, 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 etc. Then you've got to ask your question, is it still alive?
Yeah.
Has it been killed? There's known otters on. You know, is it still alive? Now, I, to be honest, I couldn't fish. Yeah. I couldn't sit in me thinking, oh, my God, you know... When you cast out, if there's a 5% doubt as you cast out that that didn't seem right, you know, after a few hours, it becomes 10%. After another few hours, it becomes 50%, and you have to reel in, right? Yeah. But I don't know how long I could actually sit out there knowing that the Cotswolds Water Park, some 40-pound carp had gone out the lake, and you're thinking there's a 50 in there called Gladys or whatever it's called, and you're fishing for that fish. And you think, I'm sitting here, is it still alive?
Yeah.
Now, you know, what other sport could be like that? You know, talk about devastating the sport, getting rid of people, you know, from our sport. When you know, one, you know, like Wayne Dunn, you know, I think he used fish in the water that got devastated. You know, Wayne, the life's away. It just devastates people that, you know, they've fished for carp all their life, or they've actually made a venue, they've stocked them with carp of 5 and 6 pound, and they've bought them, you know, they've bought them through, and there they are, 40 and 50 pound carp, almost like they're children, and people don't appreciate this, and we do as carp anglers. Hmm. You know, and then all of a sudden, a couple of otters get on there, and it's devastating. I mean, it really is devastating for the anglers and devastating for the sport.
I think we need a new jingle called Desi's Rant, I think. We just put 50p in and let you go.
Let's move on to something. I've had my rant now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree. One of the things that Dave Webb said was that the otters, they're in every county now. If you think you're not going to be affected by it, you're wrong, because otters are... they're all over the country now, and if your lake hasn't been affected yet, it will be. River, yeah. Canal, whatever.
Somebody said to me, it's not we've got otters on the Trent and we've got otters on the Wye. Now, you know, the otters, there's a great number of barbel on the Trent and a great number of barbel on the Wye. The only reason we haven't noticed yet, because we haven't noticed the numbers. And as I say to people, if you've got otters on the Trent and you've got otters on the Wye, they ain't eating lettuce.
No, they are not.
They ain't eating lettuce. So what do you think they're eating? It's just that there's so many you haven't noticed, but all of a sudden, like we did on the 7, we got more barbel on the 7 than anybody. Then all of a sudden, I was going on guide days and doing 20, 21, 22 a day. Then it was 16. Then it was 12. Then it was 10. Now it's 8. Mm. Now either I'm getting a worse angler, because then you get worse, or something is affecting it. I'll tell you what's affecting it. I see otters, instead of once in 10 years, I see otters every week. Now every day, every night of the year, they're eating one of those otters on a trip. is eating a fish. The equation doesn't work out.
Yeah. Yeah. What's talking about the rivers in general, I mean, what's the state of UK rivers at the minute, you know, compared to your experience on them in the last 30 years? I see every time we get floods, they say they need dredging and to get the water through quicker. And I mean, what's the general overall picture?
Rivers in good nick. I mean, if you go away from the barbel fishing, the carp fishing, the rivers, you know, that aren't affected by otters, you know, the perch fishing is fantastic. You know, the roach fishing is fantastic. You know, they really are in good nick. There's a lot of fish to be caught on rivers. The problem is with rivers, is it's like carp fishing on rivers. You still get a lot of people get carp fishing abroad, but they won't go on a river. It's flowing. It can flood. You know, it can change within a few days. And that's the problem. And over the last few years, there's been almost a conspiracy that, you know, the still water anglers, the still water owners, they don't want to hear the rivers are doing well. They want people on their, people on these commercials. And rightly so, you know. So they're not going to promote the rivers are good. The rivers are fantastic. What we've got is we've got very few river anglers and we've got very few people that can switch. You consider a lot of these people that are fishing still waters, they couldn't go on the river anyway. Because, you know, the amount of gear they've got, that when they're in the back of the car, they've only got to travel 20 yards to the pig. You know, on a river, nothing unusual to be walking a few hundred yards, and you can't get a barra. You know, you've got to go over stiles, and you've got to go over, you know, in any carp fishery.
Yeah.
So you can understand why, you know, people say, oh, I don't really want to go river fishing. You've got to be that certain kind of guy. But certainly if you wanted to river fish, I think the Weaver up your way has had carp for years, hasn't it? I mean, mates of mine were catching 20s up there years and years ago. I don't know how it is now. And the Ribble's got them in, the Seven's got them in. The Wyatt's produced fish in Elephant Centre, I think just short of, I think he might have done his first 40 last year.
Wow.
In Wyatt, on the Wyatt. You know, because, let's face it, people think that are slow water fish and that are still water fish. But, you know, they're not. You know, when you're considering the Danube and the mighty rivers and the Seine and the Saone, they are a river fish.
They do like moving water. The carp, you will find them in the sort of slack areas as a rule in the rivers. But they seem to be a bit healthier as well. They don't get quite as fat, do they, in the rivers?
No, you know. So yes, the rivers are in good nick, Jamie. I just think that, you know, unfortunately, you know, you have to bring in watercraft into it, you know, and a lot of people that haven't learned watercraft, because if you've got a lake full of fish and you sit on the wrong peg, instead of 100 fish, there's still 80, you know, and whereas on a river, you get the wrong peg and there ain't no fish for 100 yards.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, with the flooding and stuff, do you see a problem with the dredging and the amount of crap that's in there? Do you think they're all right?
No, there's been no problem. I mean, on a lot of the Midland rivers, all it does is move, you know, it hasn't silted it up at all. What it does is, like, sort of move gravel, you know, from one area to another area, you know, short bends out. But the EA have realised they've dropped boobs over the years. You know, they used to straighten them out, you know, straighten the rivers out and dredge them. Now, you know, they're flying up in drones and trying to find the old areas where the old river was, and they're actually dredging it out now to get the river back to its natural state is what it was, you know. So I do honestly think it's in as good, certainly, I'm 66 now and I've been fishing since I was 11. I think river fishing is as good as it's ever been. I really do. I see the old guys, you know, my age in 17, 18, say, oh, it used to be better when we were kids. But they're looking through rose-tinted glasses, you know. It's like, you know, I remember the council estate that I was brought up on, and I said to my mother, I said, Mom, is it true that years ago you could leave the door open and nobody thieves? And Mother said, Des, there's always been thieves. The problem was when we were kids, you could come into somebody's house and there was a black and white telly and a busted sofa and some lino on the floor. So do they always get a break in your house anyway? You know, and that's the same with fishing, you know. Oh, we used to catch 40 pound of roach on the float And I watch these guys, you think you couldn't catch bloody two roach on your float the way you did. So they look at those tinted glasses. It's as good as it's ever been, mate. It really is.
It's, I guess in being a multi-species angler, carp are probably at the bottom of the pecking list during the colder months for you. When do you reckon you might get the carp rods out again?
I tend to fish. I don't understand. I still believe that carp do, you know, especially on some waters, if they don't see no bait, they just turn off. You know, I don't say turn off completely, but they turn off enough for me to go for other species.
Hmm.
I love fishing for carp. I start having a few sessions, say, sort of April, May. I think that's absolutely fantastic. You know, that it's a big weight, they're feeding, springs, you know, everything's coming to life. You know, and I think the carp comes to life, it starts to feed. I really enjoy that. And the other time is just before going into winter, you know, that you know, the colour of them in the, you know, when the leaves are falling, and there's nothing better than you know, the leaves off and you've got a lot of red leaves around you and you're holding a 20-30 pound carp, and the colours, the winter colours and the autumn colours start to come in, they seem to go that the winter colour themselves, there's something about it, it's how the sun comes on them with the colours, it just, they look fantastic condition, aren't they, in autumn?
Yeah, very much so. Have you seen like tactics change? I know you used to do a bit of surface fishing. I bet you probably used the Beachcaster rig on Cutter Mill in the late 80s, 90s. I would have thought like surface fishing, but are you down with the zigs and all the sort of modern methods as or chod rigs?
Yeah, to be honest, if I was younger, I would fish the zigs. But to be honest, you know, if I don't catch another carp, it wouldn't bother me. I've caught my fair share of carp, and I love the carp fishing. But I really, take this as it is, I don't want to catch a carp 3 foot off on the bottom on a piece of foam.
Yeah.
I really, it's against, God, I was brought up thinking that these fish were so intelligent, I was probably 20-odd years of age when I first caught my first carp, and I used to read Walker and Fred Jay and Bill Keel and Jack Hilton, that these intelligent, they were so intelligent, you know, they were sort of, and it's so rare. I mean, I caught my first carp when I was about 26, 27 years of first 20-bag carp from Fandy Dread Wells. And, you know, to get a run, there was no hair rig, there was no boilies. You know, you take your hair rig away, you take your boilies away, and your baits, then see how hard it is even yes. Now. And you know, I, all of a sudden, to be given a rig that says, no, these fish that you've always thought were really intelligent, that we're going to catch them on a piece of black foam. And yes. I remember I was at the Monument once, and I was struggling. I catch a lot on the maggot up there, and then the maggots were sort of banned, and it was on the boilie. And I was struggling one day, and there was this chap, I mean, run after run, Jesus Christ, what is he having them on? And then I walked up to him, I said, what are you having on, mate? And he said, I'm having on a zig. I said, oh, I've heard about this zig. I said, I've never seen it. He showed me this little piece of black bomb. I said, you're joking. So anyway, he gave me one, and I chucked out, and I'm not kidding you, but you know, zigs are like maggots. You can cast out, and literally within seconds, it's away. Mm. And it was. And I hooked a carp, I foul hooked one, then I hooked another, and I hooked another, and I foul hooked another, and I hooked And then I thought, oh, do I want to catch carp that bad? And I'm not knocking the rigs, I'm not knocking the anglers, but at the end of the day, Jamie, you have to be comfortable what you're doing. And I ain't that comfortable doing. And as for chods, and as for rigs, you know, God blimey, I'm about to basically forget. If I went to an hard water with you, Jane, I'd say, can you tie us a few rigs up, mate? Because I tell you what, my fingers, right? Rob Hales will tell you, I'm good at finding fish. I'm good at deciding when to go fishing. I really am old school. For me to start putting two pieces of rubber, a ring on, and a ring on the thing and you know, bend him up slightly and put in a bit of braid up here and there. Mate, I'd have an headache.
Yeah, well, most people, a lot of top anglers are still just using a knotless knot, you know, hook link, knotless knot, and tag off the end for the hair and thread the boilie on. You don't have to be too much. You know, you stick that in the right place, you're going to catch more.
Funny enough, Jamie, a lot of the time with my carp fishing and my barbel fishing, especially if I'm fishing for something, you know, a bit special and might have seen a bit of action, I rarely now use... I use fluorocarbon, but I rarely use the knotless knot.
Hmm.
If I'm using heavy line, I think the knotless knot, I never use it, but certainly if I want to sort of, if I'm fishing like on the trend for bigger barbel or trying to trick a wary fish, I feel more confident in having a different material or a different thickness between the hair and the material I got on the hook line. And quite often, what I'll do with Jamie is I'll cut off... The original hair rig was a very fine hair off the bottom of the hook, not off the shank of the hook, you know, tied down, it hanging off the end of the hook. And I'll very often do that. It's just something different. And I get enough takes and enough fish to satisfy me, you know, and I just... If you fish the same as everybody else, you'll catch the same as everybody else. And a lot of people that use, you know, especially heavier lines, you know, when you start getting 12, 15, 16-pound line, there ain't much movement at all, actually, on the hair. You know, it's just the same material all the way through. You know, and I very often use even a small piece of braid, you know, that makes it even more flexible, you know. And I like that.
Yeah, my first hair rigs were cotton tied off the bottom of the hook.
I think the first one were originally Kevin Maddox's white hair, wasn't it? Something off her, you know, just the hair. I hope it was off her head.
Yeah. Have you found that the carp fishing sort of tactics have moved into the, you know, other specimen? You know, I know as people use sort of hair rigs for tench a lot now when they're laying the float on its side, same with the barbel fishing. Do you think that's all sort of come from the carp fishing boom?
Oh, yeah. It's took over. You know, I mean, in fact, a lot of us, the specimen guys now are actually deliberately wanting to use a quiver tip or deliberately using a float to get away from the self-hooked fish. You know, it has made fishing so much easier. And, I mean, typical, I remember being down Johnson's Lake only a few years ago for crucians. You know, crucians are notorious for tiny, tiny little bites and a little bubble coming up the line and by the side of the float and just, you know, just bursting on the side, taking the mickey, knowing they're speeding down there on your maggot or whatever. And yet, you put a hair rig on with a plastic caster and it nearly pulls your rod in this same fish that's, you know, sort of, you know, very cautious and whatever. All of a sudden, you're nearly losing the rod, you know. And very often, you know yourself that if you're getting little bites and you're being done by a fish, it's the rig that's wrong. You've done something wrong. Once you get the rig right and the hair rig, you know, for carp has been incredible. But, you know, when you talk about the bream, I mean, I had a 16-pound bream last year, and that was on two pieces of a plastic cord on a hair rig. You know, it just, I'm sitting there, it beep, 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 went, okay, I haven't got the strength to rip the bait runner off like a carp. But, you know, it just hooked itself. I just lifted the rod and it was hanging on. It's revolutionised all fishing. Carp fishing. I mean, most of the fish that we fish for now, we fish with small boilers and pellets, you know, maggots and things like that have gone by the board. We almost mini carp fish.
Yeah, for everything. What would you say is the sort of most exciting method of indication? I mean, I used to love fishing the quiver tip for the bream and stuff on the reservoirs, and had the butt indicators in the day where you didn't watch the water, you had to watch your indicator, otherwise you'd miss the bite. So what do you reckon is the creme de la creme?
I think any kind of fishing that you can miss the bite because the pressure's on you, isn't it? You know, there's no pressure when you're carp fishing. There really is that once you've found them and you know you're on the right spot and you've got the rig right, you know that if he picks it up, you know, you're going to get it taken. If you get it taken, it's on. You know, you just pick the rod and it's on. But when you, you know, like last night when I was on this, and I had a couple of 5-pound chub, but I missed a couple of bites because I was looking around and I wasn't really concentrating. I hit it one too early, you know, completely missed it. But, you know, I think anything where the float, it dips, but it isn't guaranteed you're gonna, it isn't guaranteed you're gonna hook it. So it's exciting. So as it goes down, you're expecting it to be on, but you're not guaranteed, and it's exciting, that is. I mean, don't get me wrong, I use the hair rig and I use self-hooking rigs probably sort of 90% of the time. But if you're going to say the most exciting times, and let's get it right, if I'm fishing for big crucians at Johnson's, I've got an air rig on, I've got a plastic caster, and the rod, the bait runner's off. I ain't going to try and be an hero on a float. But still the float and a quiver tip last night with a quiver tip right out of the blue, I had a little knock on it, and then it's whoop, shot right round, and that's fantastic, you know, it really is, you know. But, I mean, having said that, what's better, especially, I don't know, something special about some venues give you takes, like you can't believe, there's no bleep, there's no line, there's no nothing, right out the blue. You know, you get this blur of a take, you know, and you nearly shy yourself, and it's fantastic. You know, you're talking to your mate or you're half asleep, especially in the night. I mean, you know, I'll have to pack up car fishing as I get, you know, when I'm after 70, because I'm going to bloody die of a bloody heart attack when it goes off, especially, you know, the old siren goes and the light hits you and you think, oh my God. You know, and it's always a monster, anything, you know, in the dark, it's blaring away and oh my God. So even the air rig and the buzz are still exciting, making it.
Of course it is, yeah. It goes, you know, can go from complete calmness to complete chaos in one bleep, you know. It comes out of the blue and all of a sudden you're panicking, falling over the bivvy, getting out of it, or
especially if you're fishing a big fish water. And you know, I remember when I had my 75 from Rainbow, 75-14, they'd been rolling over the bait for a couple of days, and you know, the bait had been in quite a few days. And then, you know, all of a sudden, like it was 10 o'clock in the morning on the Thursday, and the rod, we were standing back probably 20 yards because we were up on the bank looking, and these fish rolled again. And I said to Robert, I said, Jesus Christ, am I going to get one of these fish? And as I can remember, just literally a few minutes or seconds after, the rod bent over. And as it's been over, and as I run down, I said, oh my God, then all of a sudden it started. Oh my God, man. You know, when you're on a venue like this, you know, is it 40? Is it 80? Is it 100? You know, or in England, you know, it's 30. Is it 40? Or, you know, at that moment in time, it's always a big one. You ain't thinking it's a 2-pounder. You're thinking it's a 40 or a 50 or that fish that you're after, which is, you know, the whole reason why I'm still going 50 years on, 60, you know, 50 years on. And that's what keeps me going, Jamie.
Have you done a lot of fishing abroad?
Yeah, over the years, many, many times. Yeah, I fish, you know, this year I'm going to Thailand, I'm going to Holland, I'm going to Italy. So, yeah, I fish India, Kazakhstan, Canada, America, India, yeah, I fished all over, really. And, you know, I've been an all-rounder for many years. It's almost in now. Some of the guys, you know, sort of, you know, are writing now as though they've invented the word of the all-rounder, you know, whereas all of us were all-rounders years ago, you know, prior to the carp taking over. Very few people were single species. We all fished for the seasons. And as I say, you know, when it came winter, you didn't fish for carp. I remember, I'm trying to think of it, Jerry Savage, I think it was Jerry Savage and a couple of guys down south, they proved, and oh God, what was his name, Bob Morris, the likes of those lads proved it, catch them in the winter. But I mean, we never believed it. We just thought they were southern nutters, you know. and it came. You know, in the winter you went chub fishing or grayling fishing, and then you returned to your tench in June, and then you went carp fishing and barbel fishing and whatever, and in the winter roach, perch, whatever. It, you know, that's what you did, or sea fishing. But now, you know, I think it's sad, really. That's why, a lot of the publications are struggling in that, if you're a carp fisherman, you just want to read about carp. Mm. And if you're a roach fisherman, you just want to read about roach. I find it rather sad, because I think if you do all-round fishing, I think it helps your specialist fishing as well. I really do. I think me being a carp angler, also... helps me being a roach fisherman, and actually being a roach fisherman helps me being a carp fisherman. It all helps. The more you know about fishing, it can't hinder you, it can only help you.
Yeah, of course. All the best carp anglers, started off match fishing or multi-species fishing. It just gives you a general understanding of nature, your environment around you, all of it. It just helps build that picture, doesn't it, in your head, to understanding what's going on under the water.
That's right. That's exactly right. I say to people, whether it be insect life or bird life or whatever, there will be a connection. The amount of times I've been on the water and said, I tell you what, we might as well go home unless we're going to wait for this period to pass by, because it's a dead period. There's nothing coming off the water. There's no swallows in the water. There's nothing coming off the water. It's a dead, it's just a whole dead night or a dead day, and if you don't get any fish, then all of a sudden, the environment comes to life. There's things coming off the water, there's swallows into the water, there's, the water's alive, and the environment's alive. There's almost a buzz in the air, and sure enough, up goes the indicator. It's all tied in. The carp aren't separate to nature, are they, Jamie? They're just part of it.
Exactly.
The more you understand the carp.
Exactly. Before we finish off, I noticed you've got a nice boat on the river. You're doing trips down there, aren't you? You want to give that plug?
Yeah, I'm doing a few trips. They're all booked again this year, the boat trips. But guiding's a big part of my life. I really enjoy it. I mean, if people look on Tattleden, the Tattles Tattleden, if they fancy a day. I do the odd carp trip. I've got a lovely commons water that I take people. I've reached this stage now, Jamie, that if you go back probably any 15 years ago, I couldn't. To be a guide and to be a good guide, you've got to have satisfied catching. You've got to be able to have satisfied catching fish.
Yeah.
Because you could help somebody catch a fish bigger than you've had. And it's no good feeling bad about that. You've got to feel over the moon. 15 years ago, I'd have cut your head off, Jamie, if there was bigger fish than me. I would be the one in your thing. I would be the one letting your tire down so you don't beat me anymore. I have been that man. But now I enjoy, actually satisfies an incredible ego to a chap saying, I've never caught a barbel, or I've never had more than two barbel in a day. And I mean, I took a guy from Peterborough, an old guy who never caught a barbel, and he got a little badge. The club he was in, the workman's club he was in Peterborough, had told him that he couldn't put it on his hat till he caught one, and he caught one with me.
Mm.
And I said, from now on, I'm going to call you, they'll call you Barbel Bill. And I can remember him sitting there. This bloke was 80 years of age. His son was 40 odd, who brought him along, and he sat there, and I saw him put his little badge on his hat, and he went. In his own world, he didn't recognise I was even there, he went, Barbel Bill. And I thought, hey, I've made Barbel Bill, and it was fantastic, that I've been able to change his life, my experiences in life, my expertise that I've learned over the years, have been able to help other people, and I hope that's my legacy in the end, the writing and whatever, that I've now reached the stage that I want to inspire, I want to inspire anglers to go, I want to inspire people to go fishing, and I want them to be successful, and not necessarily be successful just to catch big fish, to be a success, you can be a successful angler, you can be a complete prat, and I've met a few of them. At the end of the day, to be successful, if you've got a good partnership and you've had some kids or whatever, you're running a nice house and you've got some food in your belly and you go out and catch fish and enjoy being out there, then it's a success. And if I can get people to realise that, then that's what it's all about, Jamie.
Yeah, it's quite, you know, there is enjoyment in teaching other people, helping other people, experiencing their, you know, highs and lows. And that's obviously why people teach, you know, generally. There is satisfaction in it. And I think as you get older, and it's not all about, you know, that single drive that you need to become successful in the first place. And once that's done with, you know, helping other people, it is almost as rewarding or can be more rewarding. So.
The Manchester shows, you know, in years to come, you know, whether it's still going or whether it's finished or whatever, people will say, I remember taking my young son and he bought his first rod at the Manchester show. It should have been 30 quid and paid 20, and then he saw Des Taylor or whoever's, you know, yeah. Alan Blair or whoever played, and he learned and it inspired him, and he's still fishing now. And, you know, and that was all because of the Manchester show. It was all because of you. You know, and that's the legacy. That's the sort of legacy you want to leave in life, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you're there this year, 24th, 25th of February is the day. Des Taylor once again is going to be talking on the main stage. DesTaylorAngling.co.uk. That's the website if people want to book a trip.
Yeah, or go on the Tattle Den, Des Taylor's Tattle Den. If they go on Des Taylor's Tattle Den, if they want to book a trip, I can guarantee a laugh. I can guarantee a few fish. And I haven't knocked anybody out yet for missing a bite, so...
I didn't even excuse me, just getting over the flu, but I didn't even get you started on your relationship with the Matchman this time. Is it all chilled out a bit now? You still got strong opinions on the match fishing sort of scene?
No, I've got more friends in match fishing than I have in the specialty world. That's the biggest fallacy out. The only thing, you know, I've got a great deal of friends in the match fishing presenter. The only thing that I've only ever condemned about match fishing is that, you know, is about the commercial fishing, in that, you know, I think there's too many carp in some waters. If people are catching £1,000 and £900 and £800 in a couple of acre water, you've got to ask yourself, my God, you know, they're eating their own crap, and I don't agree with it. And that's the only thing I've ever disagreed with, you know, and I think, you know, that is something that's been overlooked by the carp fraternity, overlooked by the angling press. You know, keep portraying that, you know, we need to catch this many carp, we need to get... Yeah, I've got no problem with catching carp in numbers of carp or whatever, but, you know, they are an animal that's being used. Mm. Used, and I mean that word strongly, used, and in an environment that we shouldn't allow. But that's another argument. So I'll leave it on that.
Them days of winning matches with £5 a bit are long gone, aren't they? You know.
Oh, very, very much so. And yet, you know, some of those canal anglers now, they're still cute. They're still, you know, they're feeding down the middle there, and then they go over just every now and then with that bigger roach. And, you know, a lot of those things that I learned fishing the canal on my estate, there's still things I use now, but I bait and wait, you know, the sort of baiting and wait. Even when I'm carp fishing, you know, I will bait an area that I'm not fishing for a couple of days. I will say that carp fishing or whatever species I'm on, I will bait a peg for 50% of the time I'm there without fishing it.
Yeah.
And the longer I bait and wait on that particular area, I fancy my chances for a fish to have been eating on there and be confident, and by the time I get in there, I got a chance of sticking a pin in it.
Fantastic. Well, Des Taylor's TackleDen.com then, if you want to get in touch with Des, you can come and see him at the Northern Angling Show, 24th, 25th of February. And I'd like to say on behalf of all the Carpcast listeners, thank you for taking time out of your day to talk to us, Des.
No problem at all, mate. I've enjoyed it. You watch out, you go, and have a good year.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So big thank you to Des. I love getting stuck in with Des. And again, come and chat to him at the Northern Angling Show. He's doesn't do tons of carp fishing these days, but he says he's had 25 20s in the last year, which is a fairly significant amount of carps. You know, I've had many seasons without catching 20 fish. Yeah, well, especially when we fish the lower stock places. I'm sure you have too, Mark.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Have you ever been a season without catching a carp?
No. I know there's been a few years where I've gone all season and only had one carp over 30.
Yeah.
But then again, that is, as long as I get that one carp over 30, I'm happy. And whenever you get that first one, it's always, it's a bit of a relief.
Yeah, for sure. Although weights are skewed these days, aren't they? You know, I remember asking Roger in the early days when I met him, Roger Bacon, like how many 30s had you had? It was like I knew he'd caught quite a few. I could have told you all of mine at the time. There weren't many, under five. And now, I mean, I've had years where I've caught 740s in a season, but just fishing different lakes, where there are many fish of that size. So I wouldn't even begin to tell you how many 30s. I remember having 6 30s in a session out of Elstow one point, six fish all 30s, which, is nothing for that place really now. But it was quite a big deal.
That's still a damn good hit, because I remember that one more vividly because I was in swim behind taking all your bloody pictures.
Yeah, it was it was a big deal at the time, I think. It was 15 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, it was, and you did get it wrong. You nearly didn't get it right, because remember that morning, I'm driving down the A1, early hours, you phoned me up, you're in the reed swim, and at that point, you'd not had a bite, and the fish were showing for fun out from the point over a spot called the Haggler, and that swim had no one in it.
Yeah.
Now, the gist of the conversation, if I remember rightly, was you attempted just to move, which would have been easy. It's about, 30, 40 yard move at tops.
Yeah.
But you're in the reed swim and it was a banker.
Yeah.
So you had the dimer. Do you leave me to go for all the fish in the point? Or do you move, go for them yourself and leave the reeds open to me? Well, yeah, you made the right decision, because I went in the point, paced me rods out on the bank, because I'd already got my little markers, which, if I remember rightly, were bricks, just chucked in the edge. I think it was just one cast on each rod out to the spot, and I had a bite pretty quick and managed to lose it, then that was all the action for me. All the fish went round into the reeds, and I think you had, if I remember rightly, you had a 19-pounder, and then, it's like six fish over 30 up to, was the snowfish the biggest, about 37, 38?
Yeah, it was. I was actually moving, because I'd done a blank night, and it was the next morning. I'd obviously been on the phone to you. You were travelling down, and
I was travelling down after that.
Yeah, I'd put all my gear on the barrow. Everything was on my barrow apart from the rods, and I decided to move. And there was just my rods out, and I got a bite, and I landed the fish, and decided to stay home, unpack the gear again, and set the bibby up.
That fish.
yeah, saying that, you did shorter sessions then, didn't you? So you did two nights.
Yeah, I was down for a couple of nights.
Yeah, I suppose I only had two nights in the reeds, and it was in 2 days, wasn't it? That 6 30s. Yeah, to 38. That was a good session. Apart from one of the notorious brothers marching in my swim and reading me the riot act at some point in the middle of it.
That's the price you pay for catching.
Yeah, I was told if I never go in that swim again, I'll be alright on there, I'll be left alone. And not the sort of person to be told where he can and can't fish. I carried on going in that swim, carried on catching lots of fish, and was not made to feel welcome at that lake, along with you. We were personas non grata, and ended up not fishing it again after May. I think I'd had about 25 fish at that point, and then we never fished again, never went back there because of the horrible atmosphere.
Yeah, you did quite well that year. From, you know, you had that Reeds hit, and you had quite a few catches from the stick swim as well, which, you know, the year before where you'd not been a member and I had, you know, it wasn't a popular swim, but I had a few fish as well, you know, from the Reeds swim. And then we both had St Ives tickets that year, and, you know, I remember fishing another 25 odd nights on St Ives the rest of that season and didn't catch a single carp, but it was just so much more enjoyable.
Yeah, it was so much happier to go onto a lake like that. And it was a good era on there as well. Dave Lane and Terry were both on there.
Both been and gone over the couple of years before.
Yeah, it was literally immediately sort of prior. I think my first trip down there, Laney was on. Or was he? I can't remember now. Daryl Pett was on there, and his mate Ginge. Lee Jackson was on there that year. Few of the sort of old regulars. It was nice. I really, really enjoyed my time on St. Ives.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Steve Alcott was on there. Did John right. Knight?
Yeah, John
you
know, Knight.
He did Smash Picture Up. Yeah. Yeah. He was on there. And it was just a nice bunch of people, you know, really, really enjoyable fishing. And do you know, I remember one time I'd got my barrow back down to where they parked the cars at the bottom of the track. And, you know, it was Lee Jackson and Steve Alcott, and the three of us just had, you know, a brief chat, you know, as you do, just fishermen stood together. And I'm driving home thinking, wow, they're two of, like, you know, the people in carp fishing, you know, I've looked up to for a long time, and they're just real nice people. It's refreshing to see that, because you meet some people like that who turn out to be arses, but no, they weren't. And it was just a great time, great era. And we might get a bit of a stick for going on about the rotund Cambridgeshire fish every now and then, but you had to be there. It was just great fun.
It was good times. Look at those names. I remember now, Laney did catch it the year before, and he was fishing Longreach, wasn't he, that year? Or was it the little pit at the back? It was on the same complex, though, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was off on the meadows and fjords chasing blackjack.
That's right. Yeah, but you just look at that, you know, just that list of anglers, Stevie Hall, Carl Lee Jackson, Laney over the back. It was good times, and it was such a magical place, because it was back to you against the fish instead of you against the anglers like Elstow was.
You know, I do keep an eye on the lagoon, and it won't be long before it is coming back, because the fish in there, the stock is, they are, he's not overstocked at Gordon. He's put some absolutely stonking fish in there, and the stockies are over £30 now, a lot of them, so just one to keep an eye on, but just keep it quiet though, just between us.
Yeah, don't tell anyone, because
don't get too busy.
No, it's a proper war, isn't it? So many different nooks, crannies, bays, like long casts, like weedy areas, deep corners. It's like it's got it all, isn't it, really? You've got to work the lake out, as opposed to just turn up and fish in a going swim.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yes, I like it. And on that note, we can probably call it a day for this one. Episode 90.
Yeah.
In the books, first one of
2018.
I hope to have had two out by now, to be honest, but obviously the illness knocked me for six. But yeah, we should be back to being regular again. We've got a decent list of guests coming up, all new people that you won't have heard before. Nothing worse than hearing the same stories over and over again. But yes, on that note, we'll be seeing you.
Let's be seeing you.
Check out the website at www.thecapcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.